Reign of Adesanya, it returns. We're going back to Sydney, UFC 293. A lot of debuting fighters. It's a Fight Night Pick special. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. And just like that, we are back off the very successful UFC Paris card. The UFC moves things forward, and it is a Sydney fight card to get excited about. The first time that the promotions return to the Emerald City since UFC Fight Night Verdum versus Tybura. Wow. Back in 2017, Israel Adesanya's second reign as middleweight champ. He got that win back in April over his rival, Alex Pereira. As always, one half of your host, Nuo X, and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. We look at that main event. Sean Strickland coming off of an unlikely main event challenger type that he got his last time out back in July against Abus Magomedov. Strickland dispatched him inside of two rounds, so now he gets that title shot. Dricus du Plessis, where you at, bud? Strickland gets that opportunity. Co-main event, a fun one at heavyweight. 38 knockouts between them in their careers. Alexander Volkov looking to move up the ranks, taking on Australia's own Tai Tuivasa. As I said, five total debuting fighters. We have one of those debutante fighters early. It's Kevin Jousset taking on Kiefer Crosby, but a lot of things to get excited about. And of course, three sophomore sightings on this one as well. But overall, it's a pretty flat pay-per-view card. There's only five ranked fighters on this one in total. They're making you pay to watch a lot of filler. And as Dana White's Contender Series fighters continue to struggle with it, the entire roster, these are the cards that you're going to get. So one of the weaker pay-per-views that you're going to have, sandwiched between some good fight nights with UFC Paris and UFC Noche on Mexican Independence Day.
I do like the top two fights on this card, though. Let me be a bit of an upper, because, yeah, this might not be the greatest pay-per-view of all time, but Tuivasa versus Volkov, it's one of those fights where, hey, both guys are so well-known in the heavyweight division at this point, where, hey, it's a fresh matchup, it should result in a really fun fight. And Adesanya Strickland, I know a lot of people are kind of down on one half of the main event, right? It should have been Dricus du Plessis because of how good he looked against Whitaker. But Strickland getting this title shot reminds me a little bit, and I know it's not a perfect comp. Remember when Damian Maia got the title shot against Tyron Woodley, and they were like, hey, we know you're not, like, really the number one contender right now, but you've been in the top five for so long that, you know what, we'll just throw you in there. For Sean Strickland, this is a big opportunity for him, but this is a fight that he's been calling for what feels like years, so if he's going to be ready for it, you'd have to assume it's going to be this weekend. I think it will be a fun fight.
You gotta let us know who you have in the comment section on this one. 12 action-packed fights. Again, a lot of the debuts, you know us for those videos. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Welterweight debutants square off and meet in the octagon in Sydney. We have Hex's big time winner from 2023, the middleweight and then welterweight champ with that promotion. It's France's Kevin Jousset representing City Kickboxing. He's coming in here to take on former Bellator star. It's BDK, Big Daddy, Kiefer, Crosby, and Matt. It feels like forever that Fight Night Picks has been talking about Kiefer Crosby. We started back in 2018, and it was doing interviews and little things with a lot of the Bellator fighters. And that's when Kiefer Crosby was making his name with that promotion. And wasn't maybe the most awe-inspiring turn that he took over there with Bellator. He's on a little bit of a win streak to start it off coming in out of Bama. Then he has that illegal knee to the head in his American debut. Wins a couple of more and then loses a few. And Crosby goes off onto the sidelines. And the weird thing for SBG Ireland's own Crosby is, not only has he kind of been in the shadow of some of the bigger fighters out of that gym, maybe you think Gunnar Nelson or, of course, Conor McGregor with John Kavanaugh and Owen Roddy doing the damn thing in Dublin, but when you look at Dublin's own Crosby, they tried to bring him down in weight as fights went along. So if you look at him over with Bellator, two fights at welterweight, two fights at a catchweight of 165 pounds, two catchweight fights at 160, and then he moves down to 155 in his final fight with the promotion. It's a losing effort against Georgi Karahanyan, and if you go back and you watch that fight, Crosby looking to close the distance. They get up against the cage.
Georgie, what's he known as? Bellator's Nick Lentz. That's what he's known as. And Georgie's also a former featherweight. The World Series champ at one point, a longtime Bellator staple as well. But Georgie's trying to jump up against the cage to pull guillotine. He's not able to do it. But in the end, he wins out of the scrambles. He gets Kiefer Crosby down to the mat and he finishes him. So Crosby was off for quite a while. He goes out there and takes on one of the weirdest fights I've ever seen against Brian Lott and Joey, who fought on Pride 34, one of my favorite Pride cards. Steve Mazzagatti with a mustache in the background watching. But if you go back and you look at that card, Brian Joe is losing to Shinya Aoki by submission. So you think, okay, here's a guy, kickboxing fighter that fought quite a few years ago, and he's going to fight Kiefer Crosby. Do I have to sign up for Centurion FC? Yeah, and I felt weird doing it, but I did it. And Kiefer Crosby walks out to the Rocky Road, the Dublin song by the Dubliners. We've all heard that song. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And Kiefer Crosby goes out there. He looks worlds bigger than his opponent, who is a very small, stocky man. I thought his opponent, Brian, looked like a small version of Pessoa, Rafael.
Don't take away from that. He's not going to have that luxury in this fight. Like no. You said, it's a big welterweight.
You go back and you watch that fight. Crosby's an orthodox opponent, southpaw, wearing his trunks on one side rolled up to his knees, but on the other side down to his legs, like he's Art Jimmerson with the trunks.
So and right now.
Crosby goes out there, he throws his hooks, he drops his opponent, he gets into a big-time advantageous position, half-guard to mount. He's landing elbows into his ground and pound. He gets the win. Crosby then parlays that forward earlier on this year, takes on Alex Oliveira. You can find that fight with Rise FC. It was their inaugural card on Kiefer Crosby's YouTube channel. And Alex Oliveira's landing good shots at the start.
But he always does. That's the
big
thing.
Big right cross against Crosby. But what does Crosby do? It's a lot of the leg kicks. It's a lot of the hooks. It's a back and forth contest. Crosby ends up wobbling Alex Oliveira. And then Matt, for about 2.5 minutes, he beats the fuck out of Alex Oliveira, who's on absolute skate. So Crosby's last action was back in July. In a different sport, it was a boxing fight against Jordy Shore's own Aaron Chalmers. Yep. Kiefer Crosby, final scorecards in that one, 250-45s and 148-45. Weird card. But Crosby looked good in that boxing bout, so it'll be interesting to see him moving from the squared arena or squared cage to then back over to MMA. He's a well-trained MMA fighter, but when you go back and you watch a lot of Kiefer Crosby fights, it really is. Bite down on the mouthpiece, not necessarily brawl, but he starts off every combo, left hook, right hook, left hook. So when you watch his fights, they are very entertaining. Sometimes he likes to strike himself into a clinch to get his opponent down. He might have some struggles against Jussette in those respects, but Matt, what can you tell us about Kiefer Crosby that the fans might not know?
I worry that he's going to be on the receiving end of a lot of the actual leg kicks in this matchup. Not that he can't throw them offensively, but he doesn't really check them either. He will be very heavy on both feet because he does like using those boxing combinations. And for Crosby, he will have a lot of success with them, but when he does fight a striker who is at least more technical than he is, they have ample amounts of opportunity to get their own counter shots off, and that's what he's going to have to really watch out for in this matchup. He can't just rush forward with reckless abandon, hoping to land some of those shots, because if he does get into a brawl, Jussette has really good leg kicks himself. And he does do a good job of circling off the cage because he's a bigger fighter. So a lot of his opponents do either try to A, take him down because he has a kickboxing background, or B, try to crash that distance. But he has developed some good counters for that, has great knees at the middle as well. But for Crosby, I do worry about his, susceptibility to eating damage as he does move forward. Because if that's how the story of the fight goes, especially early, then Crosby's just going to be eating a lot of shots if he's not able to get that takedown.
And we saw that happen to Crosby in a second to last loss against Charlie Leary over with Bellator. And that was kind of a short notice type of fight thrown together. Leary's one of those guys that was at a catchweight of 160 that was kind of long in the tooth career-wise, but everybody over in Europe, you know how tough Charlie Leary is, and that's what the commentary
talked
about.
It was a fight Crosby probably should have won, though.
Yeah, if you watch it, Crosby's kind of closing the distance. He gets hit by a right cross. He's on Beach Street for a little bit, and he's winning that first round. He was able to do a lot of really good work, but Leary finds himself back into it, and as you watch the round continue, Leary was able to cut up Crosby, and they end the fight after the first round. They're getting back. They're ready to fight. Todd Anderson brings in the doctor, and there was a little bit of a cut and some swelling around Crosby's right eye, so it was called off. It was a TKO due to doctor stoppage. But when we look at Kevin Jussette, again, this is a guy, city kickboxing. You see him with the Adesanyas of the world and so on and so forth. But when you look at a guy like Jussette, He grew up in France training as a judoka, and he made it very, very far in the country. Junior national bronze medalist in the discipline. He was on the French national judo team. And then when he reached 17, 18 years old, he moved down to Australia, started training at Absolute Mixed Martial Arts. That's a gym that you're going to see Jack Farr Jenkins out of on this card, and then eventually over to New Zealand to train out of CKB. And when you watch these Jussette fights, Matt, again, he's a guy, I struggle in a couple of respects. Kiefer Crosby gets hit by long-rangey strikers. Kevin Jussette's striking defense is tall chin, up in the air, hands out. And Jussette doesn't really respond well to his opponents kind of crowding a lot of the distance.
He tries to just meet them halfway
and landing a lot of the hooks. Now, both these guys throw good leg kicks, but you brought it up. Kevin Jussette, kind of like a Jack Jenkins, leg kicks are almost his bread and butter. And if you do get into the clinch, Jussette being a judoka, he kind of waits and waits. Even his opponents, they can hold him back up against the cage. Traditional takedowns can take Jussette down. But when he's able to get some of those Koshi Guruma positions or those odd angle trip takedowns, Jussette really is a master of those. So again, if you look at Jussette,
I don't know if he's a master of them. He can do them.
If you look at Jussette's record, he has a 2019 finish loss to Jack Della Maddalena, who you've seen go far in the UFC. He also has a split decision loss from a few years ago for the title over with Eternal against Caleb Rideout. It's a split decision loss. I was surprised that Rideout won that fight after going back and watching it, because Jussette does get hit quite a bit, but there was a 50-45 in there, 49-46 all for Rideout. You look at the last three wins over James Crowell, who was 0-1, then Priscus Fulgagnolio, who was 11-1, 39 years old on a 3.5-year layoff, and I thought, okay, this is going to be an easy win. Really, really close fight in that one. And then if you watch Jussette's last fight, I had to buy Fight TV to watch it against Kit Campbell. Campbell wins the first round. Second round's 50-50. And then Jussette's able to get it done with the ground and pound in the third round.
There's one thing Jussette does that I hate. He throws naked leg kicks. Like, he won't set them up with his hands before. He'll just throw. And it can get quite repetitive to where, okay, if he does fight an upper echelon striker, welterweight, let's say Jeff Neal somehow gets healthy at some point and ever fights again, he would be able to have a field day with someone like Jussette, just because some of those motions are quite repetitive. So if Kiefer Crosby can start to time some of those hooks on his entries to land based on some of those naked leg kicks, then maybe he could turn what would become a weakness into something very advantageous for him. I just think the speed is on Kevin Jussette's side, though. So that'll be something I'll really watch for, because I do think from the outside, he's going to be the one landing on Crosby as he does enter. Now, if Crosby can get him up against the cage and continue to land from that point, it's a completely different story. But for the most part, in the center of the cage, I do think the movement of Jussette's going to give Crosby some issue, especially early on.
And you'll see that a lot with Crosby. He wasn't ever the biggest guy at welterweight when he was moving down to lightweight. It didn't work out there. So we'll see how he fills out at welterweight in the UFC. The stats that you see up there, 5'11 to 6'2, 74 inch reach for Jussette to 70 inches for Crosby. It's Bellator numbers, it's Hex and Eternal numbers. We'll see how they kind of line up in the UFC. But when we have a look at the matchup, Matt, France's Jussette is favored ever so slightly. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise us there to you. You sound a very pro Jussette, so I'm going to say over under 70% for the French fighter here.
I think he's going to win, but I'll put it below 70.
You're going to put it below 70? Oh, you sucker. Look at that. So 807 total votes, 69% Jussette, 79% by decision for the 31% that of Crosby, 43% by decision, 48% by knockout. And if anybody's going to sell this fight, it's not the fighter out of France. Very mild-mannered. Went back and watched an interview he did with Lassuel Plus. And it was interesting to kind of hear some more of his background. But Kiefer Crosby sells fights. He sold a boxing fight in the main event.
And that's why he's the opening fight on this card.
And that's why
he's a big seller.
He's a big seller, and it's early in Australia. So you have Jussette here.
I do, but I think it's a close fight. Like, both guys have very clear paths to victory. If Crosby can get on the inside and use some of those boxing combinations, then he has a great chance to win this fight. I just think he's going to eat some damage before he's able to get into those positions. So that's why I have Jussette.
I'm going to go with Jussette ever so slightly. Again, Jussette has poor head movement. He gets hit a lot, and he gets hit by hooks, and Crosby is able to really crash that distance quickly. So when I do look at this one, it is a tough one, but for me, I'm going to go with France's Kevin Jussette ever so slightly. Let us know who you have down below in the comment section. Some big time debuts on this card. The next fight, Matt, Gabriel Miranda sticking on Shane Young. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
It's
March Madness in MMA. Win, you're in. Lose, you go home. Marinui, it's no longer smoking. Shane Young is going to be taking on Fly Gabriel Miranda. For Miranda, a return back down to featherweight after a 3-knockdown foray against Benoit Saint-Denis in his UFC debut. Miranda, a year removed from that loss back in Paris, and a switch camps. That's always a good thing, right? Miranda now representing Astra Fight Team in his native Brazil, most recently out of MMA Masters. And I'll throw some videos out there and pictures. But Miranda, still wearing those MMA Masters trunks at his new gym. It's like having a sweater from an old girlfriend.
To be fair, though, in Miranda's defense, at least that last loss does age quite well.
Yeah, it's a giant apologist leap if you're going to say that. Because for Gabriel Miranda...
Well, that's the truth. Benoit Saint-Denis is a really good fighter.
Yeah, we had a lot of things to say about Miranda before that UFC debut. It was a fun rewatch on the fights for Gabriel Miranda. Now, the first thing I'm going to show up there is the fact that for Gabriel Miranda, if you look at his last fight and you just click on the event, it was... What was it? It was Face the Danger number 23. He took on a fighter that was 5-5. Matt's having a problem with his eye.
I don't know what's going on right now, but I cannot stop tearing up my left eye. I'm professional, though, so we can keep going.
And for the audio podcast listeners, they've really been thrown for a loop. But if you click on Gabriel Miranda's last fight against one Diego Squieira, if you click on Face the Danger 23, I'll say it one more time. It says right at the top, a prompt from Tapology, this promotion has been flagged by Tapology, promotion pattern of record padding and mismatches. Unless further evidence emerges regarding the legitimacy of this organization's event, any new bouts to this promotion will be similarly flagged, as will the Tapology
records. You're telling me Face the Danger isn't on the up and up?
I'm just telling you that. Gabriel Miranda, I'm very excited about him. You look at his record, he's 16-5, 15 of his fights by submission. This guy is, of course, a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. And if you go back and watch his fights, he is super slippery on the mat. It doesn't matter who he's fighting. It could be Joe from the grocery store. It could be Benoit Saint-Denis.
Could be.
He really does put it all out on the line. His striking, he just walks forward and throws the kitchen sink at his opponents. He does a lot of body lock trip takedowns, which work more in women's MMA than they do in men's MMA at the highest level. But you catch my drift. Gabriel Miranda is a very interesting fighter. He can get held down on the mat. He can struggle in certain positions. He is very, very slippery, though. But my God, has he taken on a paltry level competition on the regional scene.
He certainly has. I agree. His grappling does look phenomenal on the regional scene, but it's really easy to out-grapple guys who are 3-1, 0-0, 5-5. Like, those are the types of people we expect you to beat if you are eventually going to become a UFC level fighter. It's like, for Miranda, he does leave massive openings when he does try to strike. So let's say he ever fought somebody like a... Jalen Turner fights in this weight class, for instance. I know he's like a ranked fighter, but still, Jalen Turner would hit him 3 times and put him down from like 6 feet away just because that's the type of fighter he is.
So it's really funny because, Matt, you said that Jalen Turner, if Miranda ever fought Jalen Turner at 155, 3 punches would probably equal 3 knockdowns. But for Gabriel Miranda, 3 shots equal 3 knockdowns against Benoit Saint-Denis. And I don't disagree. Saint-Denis is a very good fighter. And Gabriel Miranda beat some of the worst competition on the planet
Earth
when he was coming into the UFC. Again, 1 knockout and what is it? 15 submission wins on the way. Those are definitely good. And when you look at Miranda, he was fishing for the submissions against Saint-Denis, who wasn't fooled. Now, that's a Saint-Denis that took down Thiago Moises and was looking for submissions and ground and pound. But when you look at a guy like Miranda, a good opportunity here against a smaller fighter in Shane Young. And if you look at Young, he's looking for his first win since, what, 2019? He's 3 or 4 years and 7 months removed from his wild fight against Austin Arnett, where in the closing seconds, he lands that right hook that drops Austin Arnett like a sack of potatoes. And they think the fight's over, but that's just the end of the fight, period. It was the end of the third round. For Young, his last 3, Ludwig Klein. We knew him for sidewinding head kicks. Will he finish Shane Young with one of those?
He certainly did.
Young took on Omar Morales. He was on the wrong end of a decision there. And Young's last time out, it was back home, UFC 284, or at least close to home. It was in Australia, not New Zealand. But he loses that one to Builder, who was able to strike on the outside and work in some of his wrestling and his control.
And that's been the thing with Shane Young. It's not that he always blew the doors off strikers because that's how good his own striking is. But for the most part, he would be able to beat a lot of primary strikers. But in the last 3 fights, I don't want to say his opponents have a lack of respect for him, but they don't seem to respect the power nearly as much. And we have seen him moving backwards a lot more than we ever did on his way up to the UFC or in those first few fights. Like, when Young is at his best, it's almost like a Jai Herbert fight, right? Like, he's not going to win all of them, but they are going to be exciting if he is able to do what he wants to. He's going to move forward, use a lot of his own big power shots. But with Young, he has been just more welcoming to back backing up in the fights, and that's what I'm worried about. It's a little bit... Now, Volkan Oezdemir looked great last week, don't get me wrong, but for Young, it does come down to if he's the one leading the dance, if he's the one being confident moving forward, then I do think he could go out there and completely destroy Miranda on the feet, because that's the kind of power Young does have when he has that confident kind of stance with him. But if he is just lackluster, being on the back foot, just taking whatever Miranda gives him, then I do think Miranda, for all of the negatives there are, and you're right, did he fight a high level of competition on the way up to the UFC? No, not at all.
The worst.
Yeah, like a scout out there would put it at like a D minus probably if they were being respectful. But for Miranda, the way that he was beating a lot of those guys, that granted he should have been beating on the way up, he does have a great submission ability. He does have a lot of variety to his submissions too. And I do think that if he's able to get Shane Young on the ground, especially if he's able to evade some of those bigger shots, he could get the win in this fight. But this is the big issue I have with the matchup. Shane Young may not have been looking great as of late, right? He stumbled more than he's triumphed. But I still think the worst version of Shane Young is still as good as one of the better versions of Miranda. And maybe that's a step too far to say, because Miranda does have... There's a good fighter locked away in there somewhere, right? Like, if the fight follows his idea perfectly, he can score a beautiful submission win. I just think Shane Young, and you're going to hate the term, he got that dog in him, for better or for worse. And I do think he's going to make Gabriel Miranda face and adversity in
the
matchup.
We know Shane Young has that, because he gets hit and tagged like it's in going a large out of style. Majority of his fights. And they don't get to 13-7. Without kind of withstanding a little bit of adversity. 2-4 in the UFC is Shane Young. Debuted against Alexander Volkanovski in their respective debuts. Loses that one by decision. Has a fight of the night, second round knockout with his big elbow against boxing's own Rolando D. His dad boxed. His dad, bad guy. But when you look at it for Shane Young, a bad level of competition on the regional scene that he beat. But he also lost to Damian Brown and Guan Wong, who came into the UFC, dropped Alex Caceres 1-1 fight, and then rode off into the sunset. A great what-if in MMA lore, just like Manny Bermudez, but he couldn't make the weight anymore. But when we look at a matchup like this, Matt, the safe pick, this is going to sound counterintuitive, is a guy who's lost 3 fights in a row. Yeah. His favorite to win it, that's Shane Young. We have a look at the Tapology votes in this one, Matt. I love to see what the fans are thinking. I'm going to say over under 65% for Shane Young in the fight.
I think it'll be over. I think
it's going to be over ever so slow.
It's the other way.
Wow. 945 total votes. 69% Gabriel Miranda. 29% by decision. 59% by submission for the 31% that have Young. 73% by decision. So Matt, Gabriel Miranda, last fight, Saint-Denis in tight. He got hit.
He did.
And that could be what happens against Shane Young. But I did say again, the safe pick feels like Young, 65% takedown defense in the UFC. It's bent, it's broken a bit. But when you look at this fight, Matt, what's the pick in the fight?
The fact that I'm about to pick a guy who's been, on a 3-fight losing streak, this is the crazy thing, and this is why oddsmakers kind of know what they're doing. If you just look at Gabriel Miranda's record, you're like, wow, 16-6, he's probably a really good fighter. There's a guy in a 3-fight losing streak who's almost a 2-1 favorite over him. I've got Shane Young in the matchup.
Matt, you should never let odds dictate the pick.
I'm just saying, isn't that wild? You would never see that in other weight classes where a guy is on a 3-fight losing streak fighting somebody who has a really shiny record, but that guy's still the favorite just because of his experience.
I mean, even though Gabriel Miranda's last win is over, as I pronounced it, Diego Squeria, a guy who's 5-5 on a record or promotion that was flagged by Tapology for being shady, I will go Shane Young ever so slightly. Again, I think range is going to be dictated by Young in this one. If Miranda's able to kind of go out there, play the Ryan Hall, BJ Penn, and Minari role game, we'll see how it plays out for Miranda. But for me, I'm going to go with Shane Young. We're going to get torched in the comments because the fans over on Tapology have Miranda, and you folks probably do as well. But go back and watch some of the tape on these two guys. I'd be interested to get your thoughts on it. Nonetheless, some big-time fights on this card. Matt, a lot of Anzac fighters represented, so you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
UFC.com's now going with one half of this fight by giving him one half of his name on their website. It's no longer Blood Diamond to them, it's Mike Diamond. And when you get down from Mike Mathieu to Mike Diamond to Blood Diamond, and then you got to go back a little bit, it can't be good. Blood Diamond looking for his first win in years. He's taking on the CFFC welterweight champ, Chuck Buffalo, Charlie Radke. Matt, I think this is a really fun fight because for Mr. Buffalo,
He used to be a lightweight. He was bad at lightweight. And then all of a sudden he becomes a welterweight. He's 3-0 in that weight class. He's really gained quite a bit of stock there. His last loss to Jacob Montalvo, who's a pretty darn good fighter. Before that, you go down through the list, even Radke's losses, they're a little bit forgivable if you just go by name value. One back in Bellator to Chris Gonzalez, who went on to do some pretty darn big things. And Austin Hubbard, who was two wins away from becoming the LFA champ and then getting into the UFC. So when you go back and watch tape on both these guys, Matt, for Blood Diamond, I mean, he had the one fight in Glory. It was a loss, but a really good kickboxing record. What was he? Something around 52-14 with 17 knockouts. Diamond comes into MMA as a man, not as a 40-year-old.
Exactly.
As a man, and Diamond's able to go out there and get wins over less than stellar competition. A 1-2 fighter, an 0-0 fighter in Hyungmin Hwang, who turned into a submission. So that was a good win for Diamond on the ground. And then he beat Dim Scalise, one of the best names in all of MMA, who was 4-1 at the time, and he's now 5-4. But for Diamond, even going back and watching the Dim Scalise fight, he gets held back a little bit up against the cage, withstands some adversity, wins out in the striking. There was a, 29-28s were out there in those Diamond fights. But then you look at Blood Diamond in the UFC. You have the controller loss moment for Jeremiah Wells, where he runs the opposite way into the cage and then runs himself into Blood Diamond. You have the fight against Orion Cosi, where Cosi wins the first, Diamond rallies in the second, and in the third, it's a sloppy mess, and Cosi wins on all three scorecards, so he gets it done. But again, we haven't seen the best out of Blood Diamond. He's 35 years old. I've seen him corner other fighters that are on this card, including Kevin Jousset when he won his welterweight title in his last matchup. But for Blood Diamond in a fight like this, you're taking on Chuck Buffalo in Charlie Radke's UFC debut. We can refer to him however we please, I guess. But when you look at Radke just on his Instagram bio, it is, and I quote, head jiu-jitsu coach, Team Evolution Naples. Well, that's good. He's a black belt in that discipline, coaching the jiu-jits. And then if you look at Radke, he's trained at multiple points in his career at VFS Academy in Illinois, or when those guys are coming down to Florida. So Bilal Muhammad, Matt Valley, Valley Flow Striking, Ignacio Bahamundes. And for this camp, it seems like Radke went from Florida up to Illinois, got that training in, and now down to Australia. So when you look at a fight like this, I've talked about the positives and negatives for both guys. I haven't gone through the fights for Radke yet. There's a lot of red flags. But it was a fun rewatch on the rewatch.
Oh, this fight's going to go one of two ways. It's either going to be terribly stale to watch, or it's going to be fight of the night. Like, there is a chance where if Radke, let's say he clips Blood Diamond with a left hook, because he's got a filthy left hook on him, and Blood Diamond is able to somehow recuperate and fire back with his own shots, then I think we will have a phenomenal fight ahead of us. But you did bring it up a little bit when you referenced the fight against Cosi. The Diamond cardio concerns me, especially if he's having success at any point, because it does come down to that Goldilocks effect, right? I don't think Blood Diamond has bad cardio per se, because at some points throughout the fight, even in the second round, he can fight at a very high pace. It just comes down to, can he pace himself for those three rounds and actually make it worthwhile so that he doesn't have, like you mentioned, those big peaks and valleys to his style? Because you guys know I love basketball. You know what's never been said in the history of the NBA? This guy's been bad for two seasons, but at 35, he's going to come back and put on the performance of a lifetime. Those words have never been... Patrick Ewing, when he got traded to the Orlando Magic, even Magic fans weren't saying, you know, we're getting 85
Jamaican Pat. Sensation.
Like, and I love Patrick Ewing. Shout out the former head coach of Georgetown. But for Blood Diamond, I am a little bit concerned that the holes are just so imprinted into his game that we can't really teach the old dog new tricks. Because at 35 years old at 170, it's not a weight class where you often have guys in their late 30s, early 40s having a lot of success, especially not fighters like Blood Diamond, who is such a specialist, who has a lot of room to grow in the other areas of his game.
And if you watch the Radke fights, I said he was 3-0 in his last number of fights at welterweight. All four of his last fights were at welterweight, 4-0 there. You look at the weigh-ins, though, he typically weighs in under the 170. I've seen him at 171 at one point, but 169.5 his last time out, 168.8. He's taking on Raheem Ford, who was the champ over CFFC, and early Forrest is clipping him with the right hook, clips him with the right cross. He stuns him at multiple points. Radke's able to kind of withstand some of the adversity, and in some of the takedown attempts, Radke's able to get an advantageous position. And by the end of it, Radke is able to kind of hold his own and get the win. If you look at Radke's last number of fights, before that, he's taking on Caleb Crump, who looked like Mike Pyle fighting out of the southpaw stance. Caleb Crump sounds like the name of a kid who'd get trapped in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
It was quite the hair. And Chick Magnet Punk, no longer with AEW, on the call for all these fights. Backstage stuff going on, allegedly.
Get into a fight.
When you look at Radke in that fight against Crump, it almost looked like a step back jab, and then Crump's down, and then the second strike that
down
lands
goes Crump.
It looked like a jab, but there was a little bit of a hook to it, and he drops Crump again. The trouble I have with Radke, again, the fight before the Crump fight, he's taking on Jonathan Pierzma. Pierzma was pressuring a lot of the action. I know it's a split decision win for Radke, but if you go and you look at it, I had 2-1 for Radke for sure, but Pierzma with the takedowns. Pierzma got the back at one point in the first round. The fight before that, Brandon Lopez is able to finish. I'm a 3-2 fighter. And the fight against Jacob Montalvo, it was all Radke in the first round. He lands an illegal knee in that one. So they get back up. And in the second round, Charlie Radke is completely gassed. And it's Montalvo getting him back. And that was a lightweight contest against Montalvo. But what I've seen out of Radke, again, a really good lead left hand. He can throw it as a jab. He can throw it as a hook. He throws a good right cross, a good overhand right. But he doesn't throw in combination whatsoever. He throws a little bit of a leg.
And he's very stiff on the
inside. He's got a big reset. He leads with his chin, which is never good. And his cardio is pretty darn suspect. So I've got a lot of red flags with Charlie Radke. Am I taking him to win the fight? Yeah. But the other red flag in this one, for being a head jiu-jitsu coach at a gym, that's awesome. But I've seen him taken down, I've seen him held down, and I've seen him in bad positions. And his takedown offense isn't the biggest hallmark of his game.
Gerald Meerschaert's like, excuse me?
Radke tends to get into a lot of brawls. Gerald Meerschaert parallel? Charlie Radke at Fury Pro Grappling was supposed to take on B. Joe Pyfer. Radke out, Gerald Meerschaert in. So awesome to see that. But Matt, in this matchup, Radke to be a debuting fighter is a 2.25 favorite. We have a look at the top. All
this guy's 3-2, though.
Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 85% Radke.
I'll say under.
Chuck Buffalo under 978 total votes, 79% Radke, 67% by submission for the 21% that have Diamond, 59% by knockout. Matt, Charlie Radke fights a lot like Orion Cosi. I'll take him to win this fight, but his striking defense scares me.
Chuck Buffalo sounds like he could be an MMA fighter, policeman, spaceman.
No, like, he sounds like, you know, he picked his nickname from listening to the song Sick Bubblegum by Rob Zombie. And he went, what rhymes with Sick Bubblegum? Chuck Buffalo. That's pretty good.
Yeah, go with that. I've got Radke in the matchup. It should be a fun fight, though. Like, these guys, I don't think, offer the highest ceilings in the welterweight division, but this matchup itself should make for a very exciting fight.
Look for the Chuck Buffalo Kimura sweep. The guy loves it in his fights. Matt, a big-time fight at 170. Both of us going with Chuck Buffalo to get the win. Some big-time fights in this card, including Jack Jenkins looking to kind of pull ahead of the rest of the Australian fighters. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Originally to be, Nasrat Haqparast versus Sam Patterson at UFC Paris. Out is Patterson, and in on incredibly short notice, announced on August 23rd by MMA Junkie, that Ultimate Fighter 31 rookie, the Lone Wolf, no, not Mike Trezano, it's Landon Quinones, is into this matchup. And Matt, for Landon Quinones, the fans probably know him. I mean, he debuted as a pro back in 2019. It was a draw on a Bellator MMA series card to a fighter who went on to lose his next fight and then see you later. That was it. But for Quinones, after that draw, a 7-1 run, all under the Titan FC banner. The one loss, a split decision to Muhammad Naimov, who went on to knock out Jamie Mullerkey back in June. That was a come-from-behind win in that one. And a performance bonus for Naimov. So if you look at it for Quinones, a wild career that he's had, plenty of finishes on that record. And if you consider his last two fights, he had a layoff from 2020 to 2022, major reconstructive surgery on one of his knees. But if you look at Quinones, the movement's still there, tricky sidewinder, a couple of big-time wins back in 2022, one over Reynaldo Acevedo, who got really tired in that fight and just exhaustion did him in, and then Yemi Odewale, where he was able to go out there and have a very competitive fight. Quinones ends up on the Ultimate Fighter Season 31. Coach Conor McGregor did what he did at the end of the fight. What did he say? If you had to guess, would you think he went, because he wasn't listening to Quinones, did he go, I know. Yeah, he did that. But Quinones goes out there against Jason Knight.
a.k.a. Hick Diaz. And Quiñones is putting the pressure on him. They're having kind of a knock-him-out, drag-him-out brawl. Quiñones gets the takedown and takes himself into a triangle, and he gets finished. So for Quiñones, maybe not the greatest move, but when you look at Quiñones' fights, they're a lot of fun. And for Nasrat Haqparast, a channel favorite. He came in on about a month's notice, replacing one of Matt's favorite fighters, Teemu Pakalan, to take on Marcin Held, former Bellator season 10 lightweight winner.
And he did way better than he should have.
And title challenger. And Nasrat struggled with the takedowns, but he dropped Marcin Held. So losses to for Nasrat Haqparast in a 10-fight UFC run, 6-4. The losses, Dan Hooker, Bobby Green, Marcin Held. You remember at least those, including the Drew Dober fight where he did get finished. But if you look at it for Haqparast, a wild knockdown ratio of 5-1. He was knocking everybody down earlier on. And for Haqparast, the craziest thing for me is wrestling defense. Remember his fight against Alexander Munoz, the wrestling coach from Team Alpha Male? Defends all those takedowns, matadored him, struck on the outside. Haqparast in his last number of fights, if you go back his last four, 87 of 266 significant strikes. That's good for 32.7 have been to the body. And he's upped that number as his UFC career has gone on. So look out for the body shots from the counter striking that is coming from Nasrat Haqparast. And when you pair these two guys up, I bet there's going to be a feeling out process for quite a bit of the first round, seeing as not just being on short notice this fight, but two tricky southpaw strikers in this one as well. And for Quiñones, John Anik's going to be all over it because his head coach is Roger Krall, and I don't know a guy that likes Krall more than John Anik.
Is that how you... Okay.
Loves him.
I have a really hard time with this fight because Nasrat Haqparast is such an interesting fighter, and I remember talking about this a lot before Dricus du Plessis, who should be fighting on this card, fought Robert Whittaker, and it was, hey, Robert Whittaker might be 32 years old, but it's an old 32, and I picked Robert Whittaker to win that fight, don't get me wrong, but I just wanted to make sure people understood that, hey, he's not really what his age is, he is much older, and for Nasrat Haqparast, he hasn't eaten the kind of damage that Robert Whittaker has, but he's been around the UFC for an awful long time for a guy who is only 28 years old, and we really have seen him grow up in front of us, because like you mentioned, the majority of those losses like happened on pretty major fight cards, and they were pretty big fights that everybody does recognize and remember, and for Haqparast, you're ready to go to the body more, but this is my thing with Nasrat. Is he ever going to really start making these major improvements to his game, or is he just going to make these slight alterations? Because Haqparast now is still a very similar fighter he was when he initially came into the UFC.
He debuted at 22, and for Haqparast, he's jumped around so many gyms. There's a couple of fighters on this card. They've jumped from gym to gym to gym. Haqparast from Germany, the TriStar, to Kings MMA. And in his corner for this one, he's going to have Felipe Delamonico, who's the head coach at Gracie Baja HQ. He was in the corner of Cub Swanson. Didn't really need him when he took on Hakeem Dawodu. He's been in the corner of Neiman Gracie. A lot of those guys in Southern California. But Haqparast, I think he's just been kind of pulled in a lot of directions.
This is my thing with Nasrat. When he wins fights, what's it normally come down to? His phenomenal hand speed. Like, that is the thing that does make him very unique in this division. But that's something he has. Like, that's just, he was born with that. He has great hand speed. That's not something he has picked up as his UFC has continued. Yes, he used it in slightly different ways, but you bring up the body shots. It's not like he's going to the body like a prime Mike Tyson stopping guys that way. Like, he's just throwing more of his volume to that one area, but he's always been a pretty high volume fighter. The thing about Nasrat, though, is he'll have those periods where, hey, it's great flurries from the outside moving in, but he's not a great pocket fighter. He can get overwhelmed in that position. But the thing about Nasrat is, if he could just fight like he did against Marcin Casey more often, he would be right back to where he wanted to be. Like, that was one of those performances where, for everything you want to say about Nasrat, if he could just look like even 70% of the fighter he was on that very night, that's a really skilled fighter. He closed the distance effectively. He landed massive power shots in his own right. He was able to avoid some really tricky shots from Marcin Casey in that matchup. I know I haven't talked about Keona as much. It's just, for Haqparast, the limitations of his game, but also his phenomenal strengths in other parts of his game have always made him a difficult guy to predict, I think.
And a fight of the night for Haqparast in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada against Thibaut Goody.
He beat the brakes off him.
He also had a performance of the night bonus right around that time. It was back-to-back against Joaquim Silva, who co-made an event at a UFC card this summer.
He blew the doors off him early in that fight.
He did. So when you look at it for Haqparast, the hand speed, the southpaw nature, he'll throw an occasional head kick, but he's pretty well a boxer. For Lanny Quiñones, kicks to all three levels. You go back, you watch these fights. I was very, very impressed because I thought, okay, a guy that was on The Ultimate Fighter that loses his kind of
first fight in the quarterfinals to Jason Knight, well, that's not good. But then you go back and you watch the performances that Kinnon has had, and he's going to be a guy like Kiefer Crosby, kind of a tweener in some of these weight classes. First six fights for Quiñones, kind of like Chuck Buffalo. Buffalo, 155 to 170. Quiñones, first six at featherweight. And if you find him on Instagram, the end of his handle is 145. But his last four fights have been at 155 pounds. And he seems to fill out the weight class pretty well. Both of these guys, similar size-wise, height-wise, reach-wise. So eager to see these two in the cage, see what we get out of Quiñones. If we see some of those takedowns like we saw against Azevedo and Oduwole. But yeah, all three kicks, or kicks to all three levels. And Quiñones has a really good leg kick, and he tends to shore up, and he doesn't have a big wind-up reset to it. So when you look at the odds in the matchup, Hawk Pross is a massive favorite. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Hawk Pross is a fan favorite, not just on Fight Night Picks, but on Tapology, surely. I'm going to say over under 80% going with Hawk Pross.
I think it'll be over.
And it is over. So 889 total votes, 88% Hawk Pross, 77% by decision for the 12% that have the Lone Wolf. 51% by knockout. Matt, Landon Quiñones following in the footsteps of, yeah, the only other Lone Wolf that was in the UFC. It was Mike Trezano. He went 4-3. Can Quiñones do better? We'll see. Who do you have in the matchup?
I have Nasrat, and a lot of it does come down to the short notice nature for Landon. Like, you know, or you mentioned it, August 31st is when this man was notified of the fight. 23rd, sorry, thank you. That wasn't that long ago. And for Nasrat Haqparast, he was getting ready for a very tricky fighter in Sam Patterson only a week ago. So I don't really think he would have had that long pause throughout camp to where he would kind of lose focus. And I understand, new opponent, you are going to have to train new skills. But for Nasrat, I know I mentioned he hasn't made massive improvements throughout his career, but he was still a pretty good fighter when he first came in, and I still think he's a decent fighter now. It always has been the thing, though. Every time you have a new prospect kind of fighting somebody in the top 15, you always think, oh, Nasrat's name is kind of in that category, but he always feels like he's one or two fighters away, so he is going to have to go out there and look impressive in this matchup.
This is a tough fight, and I know Hawk Pross is a 4-1 favorite in the fight, but when you look at Quiñones and the strengths that he possesses, he can strike on the outside with his kicks. When he's in tight, he can land elbows and uppercuts, and he has good takedowns. And for Hawk Pross, he was able to capitalize when John McDessie in his last fight got in close. You saw it in the second round. McDessie flies with his head out and his arm out for a spinning back fist, and Hawk Pross over the top with a looping overhand left drops McDessie. But for the most part, Hawk Pross is able to kind of figure things out and work the boxing. So for me, I will go with Hawk Pross. It does feel like the safe pick in this one. But if you guys have Quiñones, you make sure you let us know. I'd love to see these two guys square off on Friday before the fights. Question mark kicks. It's on Saturday. Final opportunity for the picks and predictions. We got some big time fights in this card. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Exciting lightweight strikers go at it in Sydney. We have Australia's own Jamie Mullerkey. Did he get knocked out in June? You bet your ass he did. He's going to be taking on Canada's John McDessie, a guy who debuted on UFC 124 in 2010. That was a GSP card, brother. And when you look at it for John McDessie, since 2017, he's fought one time a year. So it's like the Great Pumpkin, Matt. It's fall. Pumpkin spice is back. I've got it in my cup of happy mug. And John McDessie's going to fight for his first time this year. McDessie's last time out, lost on all three judges' scorecards, all three rounds against Nasrat Haqparast. And if you look at it for McDessie, it's been more wins than losses in the UFC since that 2010 debut, to the tune of an 11-8 run. The scary part for McDessie is he had a fight of the night way back when against Ross Pearson. He's going to have to stare that man in the eyes this week because Pearson's Jamie Mullerkey's head coach. But when you look at it for McDessie, you remember him for that highlight. You remember him for the low light of a spinning wheel kick knockout against Lando Venata. You remember him for his win when he's coming off major knee surgery against Ignacio Bahamondes, where he poured it on. I know that's a split decision win for McDessie, but if you go back and watch that fight, he crashes the distance and lands against the taller, bigger, rangier striker. And when you consider a fight like this, Matt, the question is, why can't McDessie do that against Mullerkey? I don't have a great answer. For McDessie, he's kind of like a Nasrat Haqparast in the fact that he used to train at TriStar. And then he trained at, what, Rufus Sport? Yeah. And then he trained at the MMA lab. And then he trained at a small gym in Southern Arizona. And now he trains at Fight Ready. McDessie's bounced around a little bit in his training throughout the years. But when you look at it for McDessie, generally, good volume, crashes some of the distance, and makes it an ugly fight. For Jamie Mullerkey, when it becomes an ugly fight, Matt, some fight fans don't like it when we say it, but guess what?
He gets put on skates. And you saw that his last time out against Muhammad Naimov. We threw the flags up there. Nobody believed us. He got knocked out. Although, his wrestling and his striking was winning that fight right up until he got knocked
out. And also, with Malarkey, I don't think it's as clear cut as, oh, if you close the distance, hit him, he's going to just, you know, go down. He does have one of those weird chins where if he's able to ease himself into the fight and not get cracked early, he can have decent durability. Like, look at the Brad Riddell fight. Brad Riddell.
Think about what you just said. He was having good durability until the second round against Naimov. Short right, hook in tight, and he drops like a sack of potatoes.
But he's had fights where that also doesn't happen. That's my whole point with Malarkey. It just comes down to how hard you're able to hit him. There are some fighters who it's just odd how their durability works. And Malarkey's one of them. I don't think he has a phenomenal chin. I don't think he has a bad chin. I just think it comes down to how many big shots is he going to eat before that big one ultimately knocks him out. And for Badesi, he is a weird fighter because he will also fight in some bursts. He's a lot closer to his opponent than a Nasrat Haqparast is, who will be very a long distance and then close the distance with his feet. Whereas Badesi does hold his shoulders very high. He does have good striking defense. That's a stat we always bring up every single McDessy video. But when he does decide to strike, he will leave himself open to be countered on some occasions. And when he is in one of those kind of Yoel Romero molds, because I guess that is how he fights a little bit. When he is in his defensive mode, he's got the high hands, he moves his feet quite well. But when he is dedicated to his own offense, he can get clipped. And Malarkey is a weird fighter too, because again, does he have great punching power? No, I think great's a step too far. But he does have awkward power, where if he's able to land, especially if you're closing the distance on him, he can hurt you with a big shot.
The knockdown ratio for Malarkey in the UFC, it's 2-4-3 against. And if you look at it, debuts against Brad Riddell. It was a fight of the night. Malarkey worked in his wrestling in the last 51 seconds. He gets put on skates and then he continues on. He had that fight against Faraz Ziam where he's working a lot of the wrestling. And I think that could be an X factor for Malarkey in this matchup. He's had more than 3 takedowns against Naimov, Prado, Riddell, and then the 5 takedowns against Faraz Ziam. And that was a big thing when he's taking on a shorter striker in Francisco Prado back earlier on this year in Australia. You look at Malarkey, goes over to the States in front of tens of fans in the Apex against Naimov. Malarkey's a -435 favorite. Naimov, 5'9", 70-inch reach. Kind of similar to John McDessie in ways. And if you look at it, Malarkey utilizing the wrestling, good striking, and then when he goes to close the distance, drop his hands and go in for a double leg, he left his head out, no defense. Right hand from Naimov, and he drops, and it's over. So, if you look at it for Jamie Malarkey, some awesome wins in the UFC. We think of the Calum Worthy fight. We think of the Devontae Smith fight. But the losses, they're definitely a little bit chintzy. McDessey, long in the tooth, originally out of Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. They'll bill him out of Laval, Quebec.
He's like April Wine.
Yeah, I mean,
from Nova Scotia. They got transferred to Quebec.
But just between you and me, he's 11-8 in the UFC. So, Matt, we have a look at this one. Malarkey got knocked out about 3 months to the day. I don't like that. And he's about a 2-1
favorite. If John McDessey walks out to roller by April Wine, I will put every dollar I have and will ever make on him. That's how excited I would be.
You'll be like Jake Hager. I got a phoner. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise dust there to you. I'm going to say over under 80% Malarkey.
I can't believe I think Tapology voters said over 80%, but oh my goodness.
990 total votes, 91% Malarkey, 78% by decision. For the 9% that are McDessey, 58% by decision. And maybe the bull, again, he walks out, he sees Ross Pearson, he goes, not today, boys. I'm getting a win in the land down under. But for me, I'll go with Jamie Malarkey to strike on the outside. He has struggled when people have kind of closed the distance between him and McDessey. You just have to go back to his second to last fight against Bahamondes to see where he could do that. But I do have Malarkey here.
I've also got Jamie Malarkey. Again, I think it would be awesome if John McDessey walked out to April Wine. It'd be really cool. But I do think Malarkey could have more success in those medium range exchanges because McDessey is much more of a puncher than he is a kicker. He will throw kicks, don't get me wrong, but a lot of his success will be once he's able to get into that distance and start using his own boxing combinations. I just think Malarkey's going to be able to at least meet his volume, if not exceed it.
We even saw the older fellow Michael Johnson rock and drop Jamie Malarkey. Maybe John McDessey's able to do that. But both of us Canadians going with a Commonwealth member, that's a stretch. And Jamie Malarkey to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big time fights, including Jack Jenkins taking on Chepe Mariscal in our next matchup. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Cracking matchup at featherweight down in Australia. We have Jack Jenkins taking on Chepe Mariscal. This is a big time fight.
Oh, yeah.
down at featherweight, a possible fight of the night between a guy who's kicked multiple men's legs apart. That's aggressive. And Jack Jenkins. And for Machine Gun Chepe Mariscal, this is a guy that came in on 10 days notice replacing Victor Martinez to take on your favorite hammer-fisted standing man, Trevor Peak. And Matt, Chepe Mariscal looked pretty darn good in that fight. Gets a unanimous decision. That fight doesn't win fight of the night. Somehow, Ilia Topuria beating the brakes off Josh Emmett. That was a fight of the night. But Chepe Mariscal looked very, very good. And we were definitely impressed by that. A good fighter coming out of a gym in Elevation in Colorado in Mariscal. Mariscal, who has fought some of your favorite fighters, beaten some of them.
Insane level of competition.
Lost to some of them. The thing for Mariscal is, he's going to give a tough fight to a guy fighting in a bar to a top 15 contender. He fights the same way every single time.
I felt terrible for him when I was watching that Joe Anderson Brito fight.
And I'm going to make a couple of examples, but his fight against Jose Mariscal, who the nickname in that fight was Chepe. In that fight, you look at the referee and he stood absolutely no chance. But if your name is Curtis Thunder, you'd think, hey, Curtis, you're going to stand a chance. So what happens? Brito goes out there, and before the fight even starts, they go into the middle, and they're jawing as the ring announcer is announcing Joe Anderson Brito. He's standing in there trash-talking. English is not his first language, and he's absolutely going at it.
That life.
So Mr. Thunder does his thing, splits them up. They start to fight. Joe Anderson rushes in there, and when I watch him fight, it's either, is this guy going to glove tap, or is he going to be like a dick on UFC 4, and are we going spinning wheel kick, and Craig gets knocked out? Well, it could be either or. But in that one, they're jawing. Joe Anderson kicks him in the cup. His opponent goes to grab his cup. Mr. Thunder goes, all right, stop. And Joe Anderson goes, bang, bang, and knocks him and wobbles him. And then the fight starts back up. Joe Anderson goes in there, throws bombs, goes body kick, right hook, left hook, knocks him dead. So again, I am very hyped up on Joe Anderson Brito.
It's a tough performance. You know, and for Mariscal, here's the one thing I will say about him, and let's just give full respect to both these guys. I'm really excited for this fight. I think this could be a fight of the night by the time it's over. I don't think the winner of this is getting into the top 15, though, if I'm being completely honest, because for Mariscal, he has a great right hand. He can throw it from any position, really. He throws it hooks, he throws it straight. You know what the problem is, though? He doesn't set it up all that well, and he will overextend with that one big power shot quite a bit, and that's something I do worry about when he fights guys.
And we've seen Mariscal in the career of one Carlos Hernandez, who looked great last weekend, kind of even intertwined, because for Mariscal, 2014 IMMAF gold medalist at the World Championships in the lightweight division. You also had Carlos Hernandez winning a belt there. You also had one Shorty Torres and Amanda Hibas, all of them successful at the 2014 IMMAF World Championships. But for Mariscal, becoming a pro, you go down through it. And again, as I said, he's taken on a very, very high-level competition. Maybe he hasn't beaten everybody, but he loses to Gregor Gillespie. He loses to Bryce Mitchell. He fought Carl Deaton, who's now in the UFC. He beat Pat Sabatini. He beat Yusuf Zalal. But then he has losses to Brito, Garcia, and Sean Soriano. If you go back and you watch these fights from Mariscal, his last time out, main event's LFA 153. That was his third LFA main event. In that one, misses weight at featherweight. That's why you see 150 pounds there. But in that one, his opponent beats him up in the first round. And then he rallies in the second round and ends up getting the win. If you watch him fighting Jordan Beltran over with Combate, he gets the win there. Beltran's record a little bit suspect. He beats Luke Faltersack over with Cage Warriors at Cage Warriors 133. They've had some California cards. That was one of those American cards. And in that one, Faltersack lands some good shots, but you end up having Mariscal getting the win. If you watch Mariscal's fight against Sean Soriano and the fight against Faltersack and the fight against Joe Anderson Brito, I think if you consider it for Mariscal, he's got a magnet in his cup for nut
shots. It must be terrible.
Because in the fight against Sean Soriano, he gets kicked in the twice in the first round. Soriano loses a point. But the biggest problem I have is a red flag in that CFFC fight against Soriano. What does Soriano excel at? The wrestling. What's Sean Soriano not good at? Wrestling. He's a good striker. So Mariscal had some success in the striking. Soriano took over in the grappling. And by the end of it, round two, round three, Mariscal was really shooting for some takedowns that were defended by Soriano, who ended up getting on top. He loses to Steve Garcia again in an LFA main event. Mariscal's been a springboard for a lot of fighters that you know, but again, he's picked up some really good wins in the past, training out of Elevation with Tatsuro Taeda in this one, as well as Justin Gaethje and some other big fighters. So again, Mariscal looks amazing, and for Jack Jenkins, his last time out, it's a win, over Jamal Emmers in one of the worst decisions in 2023.
It wasn't that bad. It was a close fight.
It wasn't that close of a fight. Emmers first round, Emmers third round, and that's all she wrote. But Matt, Jack Jenkins gets it done. 30-27 for Emmers. Troy Winklepaw had said 29-28 Jenkins by D'Amato and Lee. MMA decisions, 11 had scored it all. 11 scored it for Emmers. But when you look at a guy in Jack Jenkins, it's going to be a tough fight against a guy like Jamal Emmers, right? Because they're both good at the same things. Both good at leg kicks, both good at boxing, both good at wrestling defensively and offensively. So it was a chess match in that fight. It was ultimately a bit of stalemate. But when you do consider it for Jenkins, he's able to go out there, out-wrestle Don Chaney, the matchup before, against Freddy Emiliano Linares. He takes him down. He's able to finish him. And if you look at Jenkins on the regional scene, it is the boxing with the leg kicks to break other guys' legs to get wins. So in a fight like this, it's definitely going to come down to the wrestling, the whirling dervish that is Chepe Mariscal, and kind of the more technical but sometimes reserved version of Jack Jenkins. And I'll throw a picture up there on screen. He's doing a UFC press event with Tai Tuivasa and Alexander Volkanovski. They're dressed like regular guys. Jack Jenkins wears a suit. He's just reserved. Matt, what do you think about this fight? I think it's an awesome fight.
I think it's an awesome fight too, but this is what worries me about Mariscal, especially based off his last fight. Trevor Peake's somebody who, if you beat him, you're going to look amazing. And if you lose to him, you're going to look really bad. So that's why I have a hard time placing my expectations for Chepe Mariscal in this matchup. Because if we do just get the best versions of him from that matchup, then we will get the volume takedowns. We will get the crazy cardio he was able to demonstrate. But I think there's other guys in the lightweight division who could probably do that to Trevor Peake. Now, there's other fighters who would get hit by 17 standing hammer fists and just go down like a sack of potatoes. But Mariscal, I think,
I'm glad you're picking up on the sack of potatoes. Keep it going.
But Mariscal, I do think, looked like 20% better than he probably will the majority of the time in that matchup, just because of the way that Peake is going to fight with those looping shots. And I do think the fact that his shots are quite looping made it a lot easier for Mariscal to evade those than implement his own takedowns. Whereas with Jenkins, a lot of that offense is coming from that close distance, be it with the leg kicks or the boxing combinations. And when he is able to implement those two things equally, it's going to make it that much more difficult for Mariscal to at least accept his entries and decide when he is going to go for some of those takedowns. Now, I don't think Jack Jenkins is going to out-wrestle Mariscal. I do think we are going to get a very 50-50 match with the wrestling. Yes, listen, both guys are probably going to complete takedowns by the end of it, but I don't think either guy is going to have the, you know, 11 for 17 type numbers that we will see in some matchups, Merab Dvalishvili. But I do think for Mariscal, again, I want to get really excited based on that last performance against Trevor Peake, but the more I think about it, I do think there's a lot of other fighters who could probably replicate
and
that.
And Jenkins fights in a bit of a Thai boxing way when he does throw his kicks, because he holds his hands really high, gives up the body, and you saw it against Emmers. 19 of 59 significant strikes were leg kicks. And again, he's broken legs multiple times in the past, but when I look at this fight, the one that I go back to for Chepe Mariscal, and I touched on it in the original analysis, it was the fight against Sean Soriano. Soriano had success in the leg kick, and the offensive wrestling. Sean Soriano's not a wrestler. So when I look at Mariscal, there's other fights. Like, again, he beat Pat Sabatini. He's fought such a good level of competition. And if you're new to the channel, I picked Chepe Mariscal to beat Trevor Peake, and a lot of people tee-heed and snickered around that one. Now, I know Mariscal was a slight favorite in the fight. He's an underdog in this one. Jack Jenkins is the favorite. But there's a couple of keys here. Mariscal is like a dog on a bone. He never gives up. And I know these are kind of superlatives that I'm throwing around there, but he trains at elevation. I know he's going halfway across the world to take this fight against the hometown fighter. He's out of Victoria, so he's making the trip as well, but not nearly as long as that for Mariscal. But when I look at a fight like this, we'll see if that really high guard, the leg kicks, if Mariscal is able to switch his stances like we've seen and work in tight to the body. So again, as I mentioned, Jenkins is a pretty big favorite. We have a look at the Topology votes, see what the fans are thinking on this one. I think they gained an appreciation out of Mariscal's debut. I'm going to say over under 67.5% for Jack Jenkins.
I'll say over.
I'll say over. Oh, it's way over. 1,011 total votes, 86% Jenkins, 80% by decision for the 14% that are Mariscal, 63% by decision. And again, Chepe Mariscal, if he bites down and gets mad, it could be the Joe Anderson-Brito fight. Or it could be the fight that he had his last time out. So I think it's a good one. I'm going to go with a little bit more of the technique out of Jack Jenkins in the pick. The safer one as it would be, but what are you thinking here?
Jack Jenkins is just a lot tighter with his striking, especially defensively. You bring it up. The hands are quite high for the majority of his exchanges, and he does do a good job of digging to the body too with his boxing every now and then. And I do think those are the types of techniques that are at least going to keep Mariscal on the back foot and not let him lead the dance like he was able to do for large periods in that peak fight. So I think this is going to be a really fun one. Their styles do match up quite well, but I do favor Jack Jenkins in the matchup.
Both of us going with a man whose nickname is based off of a horse. And Fire Jack Jenkins.
Would you be Craig's Secretariat Allen? Would that be fun?
New Brunswick's own Ron Turco.
Oh, I know.
Legend. And they have a statue of him on the main
drag. I didn't want this to be a whole thing.
Up in Grand Falls, Grasse. So some big time fights on this card, Matt. The next one, Black Jag taking on Dawoon Jung. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Time banger at light heavyweight. We got a couple of them on this card. Black Jag, Carlos Ulberg, the former King of the Ring champ, is going to be taking on Sadia. Well, it's a Sadia. It's Dawoon Jung. And when we look at a fight like this, Matt, I'm not going to make a ton of musical references for this one. But if you look at Dawoon Jung and all of his performances in the UFC, a very shiny record. He's lost his last two fights. He's not favored to win this one. It's like Katy Perry's old hit. Guy's hot and he's cold. And I never know what version of Dawoon Jung we're going to get. You look at the last two wins that he has over one Kennedy and Zechku, close the distance, hand fighting, lands those standing elbows. He gets the win there. One over William Knight. He's able to beat him in every single facet of the game. And I know Knight went out on a bad streak and he lost outside of the UFC since. But when you looked at that performance from Dawoon Jung, you thought, wow, he's able to overpower William Knight and do all of these great things. That's awesome. Jung's performance before that, that split draw against Sam Alvey, where Jung just didn't look great as it went on. So for me, with Dawoon Jung, the striking on the outside, his boxing's his best weapon, his offensive wrestling's pretty good. And when you're taking on a guy like Carlos Ulberg, who is one of those kickboxers to the nth degree, to a certain range here at light heavyweight, it could be tough, especially if you look at Jung's last two losses. Dustin Jacoby finishing him relatively early, and then Devin Clark. Jacoby, we know the glory lineage. Carlos Ulberg, he's won four straight since he lost two. Kennedy and Zechiku. So if we're playing that tinfoil hat MMA math, well, Jung wins because he beat Zechiku and Carlos Ulberg lost. But if you look at Ulberg's recent string of performances, beat Ihor Putseria, beat Nikolai Negu Mariano, beat Tafan Chukwe, and beat Fabio Charron. Even though Ulberg was looking like he was going to lose or was losing against Stefan, he's able to get the win there. It's just, for Ulberg, we've seen him grow against the level of competition. And for Dawoon Jung, we've seen the opposite lately.
So here's the thing. You're telling me a guy on a two-fight losing streak is going to go fight another guy the UFC wants to be a star in what's basically his hometown. I understand he's from New Zealand, but it's very, very close to where he's from, and he's going to get a big pop from the
crowd. It's like when Adam Fugette fought Mike Malott in Vancouver. Who's closer? Fugette. Who got booed?
Just Fugette. My point is, if this was boxing, Carlos Ulberg would be like a minus 7,000 favorite, because if it goes to a decision, he wouldn't lose. I just mean, for Ulberg, this has all of the recipes for, hey, Ulberg's going to win some crazy stoppage victory. Now, with me saying those words, it basically just guaranteed Dawoon Jung the greatest win of his career. But I do think Jung is going to have a really hard time from that outside, where we normally see him have a lot of success. That's the thing. If you're a striker on the outside, that's great. I'm really happy for you. You know what type of fighters you don't want to fight if you're a striker on the outside? Guys like Carlos Ulberg, who use that distance very well, move their feet very well, and if they aren't under the threat of either a massive puncher or someone who can go for a high volume of takedowns, which for Jung, it's been a weird mixed bag, right? In some fights, he will have great offensive wrestling, but we also have seen him just not really use it at all and kind of be happy to stand on the feet and trade with his opponent. So until I see Jung be very committed to the takedown in this matchup, it is difficult to see him, A, be able to set up those takedowns from range with his own strikes, and if he's not able to get the respect of Ulberg and just finds himself shooting in from a further distance than he wants to, well, that's just going to help the counter strikes of Ulberg that much more.
And Jung, he's got to build it back up for Korean MMA. Obviously, we saw the zombie.
Tears were in my eyes.
Tears flowing. But yeah, Korean Zombie losing here the other week to Max Holloway. For Jung coming into the UFC, standing guillotine against Khadis Ibrahimov. He beat Slow Mike Rodriguez. These are building blocks. He was a big guy over with Heat. He beat Hulk. You know, Hideki Sakine, that guy. A lot of fun fights.
Not a young man.
A lot of crazy fights. But if you look at it for Jung, he hadn't lost from 2015 until most recently. And that was a loss to heavyweight Roky Martinez. So it had been a while for Dawoon Jung, a really long win streak. And if he's able to get the grappling going, the wrestling going that we've seen in maybe the William Knight fight or the grappling to jiu-jitsu against Kadys Ibrahimov, a guy who was a boxer coming in, then maybe Jung's able to get the win. I don't like the line on Carlos Ellberg. I know what you said. You know, he is a fan favorite, I guess. Like, yeah. Do you get your girlfriend to watch a Carlos Ellberg
fight? Of course not.
Yeah, exactly. Good answer. So when you do look at it for Ellberg, he attracts eyeballs.
Bro, my girlfriend's on the same planet as you. Please don't be on TV.
Carlos Ellberg, Matt, 1,093 total Tapology votes, 95% Ellberg, 86% by knockout for the 5% of Jung supporters, 38% by decision, 36% by knockout. Again, if Jung's able to go out there and wear on Carlos Ellberg, we saw what happened against Kennedy and Zetchkov. First round, Ellberg looks like a dynamo. Second round, he's got no cardio, and he gets finished by Zetchkov. Jung could wear on him, tire the arms out. Go out there and fight a Blagojevanov fight. Just wear on him, snap down City like you're Tony Ferguson, and make it a boring fight, and Jung could win if he's able to slow down that timepiece. I do like Ellberg on the outside with the kicks. We'll see how this one goes, but I'm going with Black Jag.
I rarely say this. I think Ellberg's going to win by stoppage. I just think he's that much faster than Dawoon Jung, especially on
when
the
outside. When Jung wins, you're going to look like a
That's fine. An absolute I turkey. Own up to it every time I do look like a turkey. But and I rarely make predictions like this. Craig, you also said Chinyan Jokowani was going to stop Michael Olazechuk. So listen, Matt, we all have predictions that go south.
I've had 135 odd predictions this year that have been wrong. If you're going to pick out a few of them.
Wait, like you just tried to do with me? Wait, the mental gymnastics that are being played to my right. I've got Carlos Ellberg, and I do think he's going to stop Dawoon Jung.
A big time fight in this one. Both of us going with City Kickboxing's Carlos Ellberg to get the win. Matt, we move it on to the main card, and it sucks. We get some fights, and you're going to enjoy them. We're going to break them down. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
They want you to pay your good money to watch this fight in the UFC 293 main card. Matt, we have Tyson Pedro taking on the pleasure man, Anton Turkali. And in this fight, Matt, Turkali wins on Dana White's Contender Series 2021 in week one, but he wasn't Bijo Pfeiffer. He had a boring fight against Ocasio de Santos, took him down in 11 of 14 attempts. And it wasn't all that fun to watch. And this is a Turkali that was a Swedish wrestling champ. He trains out of All-Stars with, I mean, it's back. No Time, Volkan Uzdemir, Hamzat Shamayev, and the like. Turkali's UFC debut on short notice at a catchweight. Takes on Jaltan Almeida, gets submitted. He had a fight of the night against Vitor Petrino his last time out. 30-26 and 230-27s. Some back and forth in the grappling. Petrino was able to get the win. But for Turkali, we definitely haven't seen the best of him. He's lost these two UFC fights, looking to get back to his winning ways. And Turkali's last win that was outside of the kind of Zuffa or Endeavor banner, he goes out there against Konstantin Soldatov with Brave. Throws a head kick that misses and then spins out of the head kick and throws a back
it
fist.
Was so cool.
And knocks out Soldatov. You knew Turkali for big throws, big wrestling actions. And he is a fun fighter when he can get his ground and pound going, because unlike some of these other fighters that are on this card on the prelims that struggle with like their hip position and their overall top pressure, kind of like Felipe de Santos is higher up on this card after this fight, Turkali's got really good top position. He's really heavy there and he can land a lot of ground and pound. And for Tyson Pedro, you knew him for his jiu-jitsu. You knew him for his karate coming into the UFC. And from 2018 to 2022, he had that long layoff, the knee injuries and so on. He gets wins over Ike Villanueva and Harry Hunsucker. One at heavyweight, one at light heavyweight. His last time out, he was a pretty darn big favorite taking on Modestus Bukauskas. And in that one, 30-27.
That was a close fight, actually.
229-28 for Bukauskas in the win. And for Tyson Pedro, it almost seems like he kind of slowed down a little bit as that fight went on against Bukauskas.
I'm not a big this guy should have won, that guy should have won, but that was a really close fight. I know you bring up there was a 30-27 in there, but like those guys were real tit for tat with their striking. Pedro did score a couple takedowns of his own in that matchup, so it's a much closer fight than how Craig may have just described it, is all I want to say. This has been my problem with Tyson Pedro his whole career, though. He's just kind of fought
fought people at the same level. Like, when is the Tyson Pedro push really going to happen to where we can get convinced, okay...
Are you kidding?
No, he fought Shogun that one time, and that was really about
NOSP, that's when they were trying to push Tyson Pedro.
They were, but the problem was, okay, he got to that level, had one injury, and for the most part, he's just kind of fought guys who were well outside of the top 15.
Because they were trying to build him back.
I understand, but he had multiple wins there. And Bukauskas, that's a good opponent, don't get me wrong, to people like us. But a former middleweight who moved up to 205 and you having a close fight with him isn't the performance that people want to see. I just think for Tyson Pedro, like, when is it going to happen to where you are going to become that contender?
Who is a former middleweight?
Bukauskas.
No, he's always a light
heavy. My bad. But my point with Pedro is, he should have beaten guys like Bukauskas if we were going to be convinced that he was that top-tier prospect. I know he had that crazy fight with Khalil Roundtree coming off of the Ultimate Fighter. He gets dropped by Khalil in the first round of that fight, and then he's able to get the rear naked choke win himself. It's just for Pedro, he has skills in every area of MMA, be it on the feet, on the mat, or with his wrestling, but he also has deficiencies in all those areas too that we have seen taken advantage of. And that's why I've always had a hard time with Pedro. Is he a great striker on the outside? Yeah, he is. But we've also seen him get tagged by other good strikers in the outside. Does he have good offensive wrestling? Of course he does. But guys like Ali Latifi were able to take him down multiple times in their matchup, and he really didn't have an answer for it. And even with his submissions, we haven't seen him just get convincingly out-grappled for the most part, but he's not so good at submissions to where it's a one-hit, one-kill when he's able to get it on the mat. I just think with Pedro, there's a lot of pieces to like, don't get me wrong, but behind every single one of those pieces that you do enjoy, there is a weakness there as well.
Well, the two opening UFC wins for Tyson Pedro, Roundtree and Paul Craig, both being first round wins, those age really well in a vakuum. You look at the fight against Saperbeg Safarov, who was able to work the takedowns, and then you have the submission win for Pedro. You look at the fight against OSP, in the next fight he drops OSP, and then he gets caught in that arm lock. So again, they build him back up, getting the wins over Villanueva and Hunsucker, and he was supposed to take on Zhang Ninyang, who was a fighter that fought on a one-time road to UFC card. And then that fight fell out. But if you look at it, yeah, the loss to Bukauskas for Turkali, a lot of the takedowns. And even in his fights against Herkeletics over with Brave, a 41-year-old Greek fighter, he runs across the cage, lands a flying knee, gets a takedown. I watched Anton Turkali fight with RXF in his opening pro fight. Runs in, flying knee, works the takedown. So that was a big thing for Turkali on the regional scene. We'll see what he's able to do in this fight. Pedro is a slight favorite, fighting close to home in Australia, -130 favorite, Oda City Kickboxing. If you look at it for the Topology vote, Matt, I'm going to say over under 72.5% Tyson Pedro.
I think it'll be under that.
And it's slightly under. 1,022 total votes, 69% Pedro, 59% by knockout for the 31% that have Turkali, 60% by decision. Matt, I think Anton Turkali wins one of the more boring fights that you're going to find on this card, and I've got the pleasure man to pick up his first UFC win.
I have Tyson Pedro to win, but if you can't tell from the way that I've talked about this fight, I've sold all my Tyson Pedro stock, and I'm a guy who still is invested in Dante Exum. Back in the league, by the way, with the Dallas Mavericks. So I have Pedro to win the fight, because I think if Turkali does get repetitive with a lot of those takedown attempts, Pedro does have the other skills in his game to start countering it with shots in the outside, and at least maybe try to go for some submissions to make it uncomfortable so he's not so repetitive with those strikes. But Turkali has a great chance to win. If he is able to rinse and repeat with those takedowns, then I don't know if Pedro's going to have the defensive wrestling to get back to his feet that consistently.
Both of us are split on the pick. I'm going with the fact that I think Pedro's going to lose to another Swedish fighter, and Matt going with the fighter fighting at home. So Matt with Pedro, me with Turkali. Some big time bouts on this card, including a rematch in a fight that ended by an eye poke. We have Austin Lane taking on Justin Taffa. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Justin Taffa, Austin Lane. Have they fought before? Yep. 29 seconds in, Austin Lane lands two body kicks and a punch, and then he rakes the eye of Justin Taffa. Taffa can't continue. It was a very long layoff. Listen, Dan Mergliotta did all he could do. The doctor that looked just like Bob Odenkirk said no, he can't continue. He said he can't see. So ultimately, Matt, we get a rematch of this fight. And gosh darn it, we talked a lot about it in the original time. So let's talk about Justin Taffa and Austin Lane. Do you like Tim Sylvia? Do you like Heath Herring? Do you like Big Nog? If you consider this matchup, Matt, this is the most 2008 heavyweight fight that you're going to get in 2023. Coming up this weekend, we have Badman Justin Taffa taking on former NFL player. And it's real. He's a real NFL player. Austin Lane, a man who was drafted in the fifth round by the Jacksonville Jaguars. and he had a cup of coffee with the Detroit Lions at the end of his career. But last weekend, Zach Paunga, they said he played for the Houston Texans, didn't play a snap for them. Austin Lane so really impressive. Started games in the NFL, and if you consider it, I mean, players to come out of Murray State. Quincy Williams, also drafted by the Jaguars. Not a lot of big-time fighters, or at least NFL players, out of Murray State.
Didn't John Morant go there?
But a guy in Austin Lane that ran a 4.58 40. So wild for Austin Lane. Parlayed that into an MMA career. A lot of early finishes. Fought Greg Hardy on Contender Series. Lost. Picked up some more wins after losing his fight off Contender Series. And then you had Lane coming in, getting that big win his last time out, and ultimately making his way into the UFC. Beat Richard Jacoby. We did a big video ahead of that on our Contender Series show, so let's throw it on over to a clip from that show. And the comment was out there of how good Austin Lane looked on the scales. This guy's 6'6 at heavyweight. He has an 80-inch reach. And Richard Jacoby, 6'4, 75-inch reach.
I don't know, man. Not that you're saying is wrong, but I'm not sold on Austin Lane either.
No,
Austin Lane, I vividly remember for being super hyped up before he fought Greg Hardy. They were like, hey, this is the top-ranked Southern United States heavyweight. That's what they were calling him going into that show. It was like one of those baseball stats where they're like, this guy hasn't given up a run in the 4th of May in 6 years. But for Austin Lane, he was really hyped up on his first entry into Contender Series because he is that big, intimidating-looking heavyweight. When he can fight on his terms under his rhythm, he is really good. But the problem is, guys get on the inside of his reach very easily, and he's not a durable guy once they do. He's not someone who can then, okay, make the fight really ugly, fight his way to the outside, circle off, and then get his distance back. If you make it ugly, there's a very good chance that one of your shots can reach his chin at a certain point. And if it does, up until this point in his career, he hasn't really shown the best susceptibility to getting hit by shots. Like, I remember the Frank Tate fight right after the Greg Hardy fight, too. They were like, wow, Austin Lane, he's getting back on the train. And what happened in that matchup? He also gets stopped. So for Lane, I think the skills are there, but there's also a lot of those pitfalls too that the classic heavyweight can fall into when they believe in their own power a little too much.
And this fight's really weird. Like, again, if you didn't know, Austin Lane was on season 2 of Dana White's Contender Series 2018, gets finished by Greg Hardy in 57 seconds. And I see it in the comments, Matt, from CT710 saying Lane is so long, but he does this thing where he leans in and throws combos and is going to get caught. And Dan Goldstein says Lane was catching butterflies after Hardy hit him instead of defending the next shot. One shot will boop him, not as the favorite. And CT also finishing up saying if he was fighting a wrestler, it'd be free contract for his opponent. The weird thing about this one, yeah, I think Austin Lane, very good striker when it's on his own terms, and he hasn't fought the best level competition either. Like, you consider it, his last two wins are really big. He finishes Juan Adams in the Fury FC title fight in the 4th round. You like to see that durability. He beats Eric Lunsford his last time out to defend the belt. That was back in February. His other losses, you said Frank Tate, one to Greg Hardy, one to Vernon Lewis, who's been good with LFA, who's been good with Bellator as well. So Jacoby, being an accredited striker out of Brazil, low volume, high power, gets the takedown against Austin Lane. That gets reversed, and then it's Lane landing the ground and pound. Now, this is an awkward fight because Tafa, Junior Tafa, was supposed to welcome Austin Lane into the UFC at UFC 284. Lane is out due to a bicep injury. I won't show it, but you can go to his Instagram and see the muscle popping out. If you look at it for Lane, now he gets this opportunity against Justin Tafa, not Junior Tafa. And Matt, this is where I'm going to lead it off to you. I will admit when I'm wrong, and I will admit when I'm wrong often. Out of Justin Tafa fights in the UFC,
I think people have watched our videos.
I'm 2-4 in picking Justin Tafa fights. You're 3-3. We've been bad at picking Justin Tafa fights.
Because he just fights in one of those 50-50 kind of styles. You know, when you rely,
heavyweight style?
When you rely on the power like a guy like Justin Tafa, it's going to leave a lot of holes in your game because you just rely on that one massive outlier. Chris Davis is who I bring up all the time. Now, Chris Davis might have been on Adderall when he hit a lot of home runs, but Davis was a guy who relied a lot on his power. And then when everything else started to fade away and he just had the power, there wasn't really enough left for him to maintain his spot at kind of the major league level.
The two Chris's, Chris Davis and
Baltimore Oriole Chris Davis.
Baltimore Oriole Chris Davis, not Crush Davis or Crush Davis if you want, but Chris Carter as well that played for Houston.
But this
leads the league in homers, and a few years later, he's out.
Well, like, Kyle Schwarber is probably going to be playing for, like, a regular, like, house league here any day now, because Kyle Schwarber's a negative war player but hits a ton of home runs. My point is, with Justin Tafa, he is one of these outliers who relies on his outlier strength, which is good. You want a guy to do what gets him to the dance, but when Tafa does rush forward recklessly, we saw that in his fight against Jorgen De Castro, right? De Castro closed his eyes and threw a right hand, and it was still enough to knock out Tafa. What I will say about Austin Lane, though, is,
I know they bring it up a lot in the Greg Hardy fight, but no matter what your thoughts of Greg Hardy was, he was a really good athlete, right? Like, you don't make it to the NFL without being a really good athlete. Austin Lane at 6'6", I do think has plus athleticism. He's a big guy who uses his speed and uses his strengths quite well, and he moves well for being such a big frame at the heavyweight division.
He kicks well, and he closes distance really well.
But the thing that I do worry about with Lane is, he's a guy who stays for the receipt, to quote Teddy Atlas, when he throws a lot of his boxing combinations. That's how Greg Hardy was able to catch him. When he throws a lot of those bigger straight shots, there is a detriment to having, you know, massive arms and being a really long-rangey striker. When you miss on some of those rangier strikes, you can get caught by counter shots. Now, I don't know if Taffa's going to have the head movement to really be able to duck out of some of those initial shots and make him pay for them, but this is one of those fights where I think it's pretty easy to lay out a game plan for how both guys could win.
I disagree with you on Taffa in two respects, because again, I'm 2-4 in picking his fights, so it's not good, but the breakdown of a Taffa fight, yeah, he overreached in that fight that he had at Marvel Stadium in his UFC debut against Jorgen Castro. The other two losses, a really close decision to Carlos Felipe and a close decision to Jared Van Deren. Justin Taffa is one of those guys, you see it on screen, 266 his last time out. He came in at 267 against Harry Hunsuck at Hunsucker, and he ended up getting the knockout win. You look at a guy like Justin Taffa, and the thing that he does really well is undervalued in MMA. Now, Dan Tom got me onto this, and now all of a sudden, it was like a switch in my brain. Justin Taffa, in all six of his UFC fights, 64 of his 180 significant strikes landed are body shots. And in the two losses that he has that aren't the knockout loss against Jorgen De Castro, 32 shots and 28 shots to the body against Felipe and Van Deren.
Because they just put their heads together and threw boxing combinations.
32 of 74 strikes and 28 of 77. Justin Taffa lands a heavy preponderance of body shots. And against a guy like Austin Lane, who's going to be headhunting, we'll see how that plays out. Because if you're ducking, if you're making any sudden movements to go to the body, Lane can catch you on the way in with those kicks, with those really long hooks that he has. Now, who has a speed advantage? I have a tough time saying it in this one.
Well,
it
depends
on
the range, really. If Lane can stay on the outside, he's just going to be able to the one who can pepper Taffa a little bit easier. But on the inside, I do think Taffa, even though he throws those big looping shots, they're going to be enough to land.
It'll be interesting to see what we get nonetheless. And the big thing, when I look at a guy like Austin Lane, you watch a guy that throws so much fury, so much power at you, but he's not like one of the upper echelon guys at heavyweight. He's like one of them, but he's not like a Francis Ngannou or a Derek Lewis, somebody that's going to plant their feet and throw that big power shot. Lane's going to throw it, but he may be off balance on his front foot. He might be off balance on his back foot. And if he misses, you're out of position. You get countered. You get knocked out. If you land, you look like Jairzinho Rozenstruik, and then you make your way all the way up to the top five. So Austin Lane, it could be a very interesting career path. He makes his debut at 35, so a little long in the tooth, but it is still heavyweight. And if you look at it for Justin Taffa, an accredited striker nonetheless, and he is the younger man in the matchup, we'll see how the weigh-ins make out for both guys, because one guy's missed the heavyweight limit. So in the original fight, Austin Lane, plus 160. Justin Taffa, minus 190. 29 seconds of action. The body kicks, they were aplenty from Austin Lane. And as the commentary noted, Lane needs to be able to keep the distance, land the kicks. Taffa needs to be able to close the distance. Taffa gained 50 points. He's more of a favorite now than he ever was, which is wild. But when you do consider a fight like this, we both had Lane in the original video. Who do you have now?
This is an oddly close fight. I don't know why either guys like justified their fact to be a favorite in the UFC, because yes, Taffa is the more known commodity at the UFC level, but Austin Lane, and they're going to bring it up a lot in the broadcast, you guys are going to roll your eyes when I say it now, guy's a good athlete. I know he's 35 years old, but for a heavyweight, he does move very well on the feet and he does land good straight shots. I can't believe I'm switching my pick based on a, 29-second fight, like you said. But I do think Lane is going to have a difficult time in that medium to close range in this matchup. And if Taffa excels anywhere, it's once he's able to get, like, forehead to forehead, chest to chest, he can land really effective strikes from that position. So I'm going to go with Justin Taffa ever so slightly. But it's unranked heavyweight MMA, guys. Anybody can win if they land one shot.
1,065 total Topology votes, 83% with Taffa, 89% by knockout. For the 17% that I've Lane, 70%. By knockout, I still have Austin Lane. I like the kicks on the outside that he was able to throw early, but he landed three strikes to none and then an illegal eye poke. So we'll see how the mind games play out. A fight like that happened one time in a UFC main event. They rematched them on a main card. It was Jeremy Stephens against Yair Rodriguez, and Yair Rodriguez was able to get the win in that one. He was the eye poker in the first match. Matt, we're split on the pick in this one. A big-time fight in the next one. We have the 10th-ranked flyweight Manel Kopp taking on incredibly short-notice UFC debutant Felipe Dos Santos, a.k.a. Lipe Daytona. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Originally to be number 5 versus number 10 at flyweight, out is Kai Kara-France due to some concussion symptoms. So in on incredibly short notice, it was announced on August 21st that Lipe Daytona, Felipe dos Santos out of Shoot the Box Diego Lima down in Brazil, would be taking this fight. So now we're in a funny, funny zone. We're in the Steven Ersig zone. And if you don't know what that is, Australia's Steven Ersig, on about a week's notice, took a fight against then number 10, David Dvorak, who Manel Kopp was able to beat in his last win. But if you looked at that fight, Ersig, we knew he had all the tools, and all of a sudden, boom, you get that win over Dvorak, you're in the rankings. So Felipe dos Santos looking to jump the queue. He was originally supposed to be on Dana White's Contender Series Week 3 from this past summer against a tricky fighter in Luciano Pereira, who had a bad weight cut. So dos Santos is out, he's on the sidelines, and now he gets this fight. Now, that fight was supposed to be a couple of weeks ago. So you go from cutting weight in Brazil, you go to Vegas, you get ready to weigh in. Now you got to go from Vegas all the way over to Australia and try and cut weight again in 2 weeks. But for Felipe dos Santos, what I've seen out of his fights, this guy is a wild, wild striker. When you watch Felipe dos Santos fight, he flicks those front kicks out there from the orthodox stance, but with both feet, he throws really long punches, and there's a lot of pop on those. He likes to offensively wrestle, but when you look at a guy like Felipe dos Santos, Shoot the Box Diego Lima is all the rage right now. Charles Oliveira, Ian Machado, Gary, Alan Nascimento, Daniel Willicat. There's so many fighters that dye their hair platinum blonde, and they go out there and they end up fighting into the UFC. And when I watch dos Santos, I kind of look at him more like a Mateus Mendonça that trains out of that gym, even though recently they dyed their hair blue on top. But a lot of pop at the end of their shots, a lot of reckless abandon, not a lot of good defense when it comes to other strikers, especially when they're fighting smaller strikers that throw hooks. That's what's coming up. But a lot of range and a lot of pop.
Dos Santos fights like a 22-year-old would fight in your head. You know, like, he does throw the kitchen sink at you, doesn't really worry about what's coming back his way defensively.
Did this guy just drink polar ice the night before?
I was going to say more like Four Locos. Like, Dos Santos gets after it. And again, he does fight a little bit like a Cowboy Oliveira, to where at that long range, he will throw punches from both angles. He does do a good job with both stances, but he is a little bit awkward with it. And if Manel Kopp is able to judge that distance effectively on the outside, and this is before he even implements some of his own takedown attempts, because I do think we will see some out of Kopp just to disrupt that rhythm out of Dos Santos, especially on the outside when he's using his own kicks. But if Kopp is able to duck, parry a couple of those shots, and meet him halfway with a couple of his own overhands or right hands at all, I do think it's going to be able to hurt Dos Santos a lot more than what his shots are going to do to Manel Kopp. But this is a tricky fight for Manel Kopp, because it's a fight he should win, and it's a fight people expect him to win, and that's always a difficult position to be in, because for Kopp, he had those two weird losses earlier on in his UFC career to good fighters, don't get me wrong, but they were fights that, okay, they kind of justify you're at this level, right? Now you have to maintain your spot in this division, and 125 isn't what it used to be, right? There was a time where 125, if you lost, they said goodbye to you no matter what ranking you were in the division, but now it is a fairly deep division where you can see multiple people challenging for the title one day. So for Kopp, it's really important for him to not only get a win, but try to prove his spot in the division, because there's no rightful number one contender right now at 125 pounds. So Kopp, let's be honest, is probably going to have to win one more fight after this if he does want to get into that title picture. But he's got to look impressive in this fight to then justify that number one contender
and
spot.
If he got a win over Kai Kara-France, that would have been
exactly,
that one.
Exactly.
Again, you go from 10 to 5, and then you're into the picture. And Kopp, as Matt referenced, he was the Ryzen Bantamweight champ over in Japan. He had that win over Kai Asakura in their second fight. Kopp was a guy, a lot of wins. He faced some early struggles over there, and then he was able to withstand it, get himself into the UFC. Had that little bit of an athletic commission, you saw it, a complication there not that long ago. But his last win, he was all over it against David Dvorak. And that was where Dvorak started to kind of lose a little bit of his luster. Wins over Zhalga Shumagulov and Ode Osborne before that. So if you look at it for Kopp, obviously the weigh-ins are always a little bit of a question mark. We've seen that so far in the UFC. For Lipe Daytona,
I now go by the name of Daytona, Jackie Daytona.
Yeah, kind of like Jackie Daytona from what we do in the shadows. But when you look at a guy like Daytona and his striking against some of the smaller guys, his last couple of wins, a lot of volume, poor striking defense, good takedown offense, poor takedown defense, good jiu-jitsu. But if you watch some of his fights, like, the thing that I noticed out of Dos Santos is, for as much pop as he has, for being a taller, bigger guy at 125, he doesn't have that tall man lean back with his head back. And if he is leaning at all, it's always in pursuit of extra offense. The spinning back fist, a couple of fights ago, he went spinning back elbow into a spinning back fist from the other hand. He's very, very creative. And you would think, watching Dos Santos fights, he burns his tank in the first round. I don't know how he keeps it going in the second and the third.
The Four Locos.
But that's what we've seen in his last two fights. And where he's had a step up in competition against Rafael Monturo, split decision win there, and over Hugo Paiva, where he's faced better guys, they've gone to decision, but all the fights before that are by finish. So I don't necessarily see a finish in the cards for a guy like Dos Santos. Maybe somehow he's able to pull a rabbit out of his hat a few weeks away from his 23rd birthday and win a decision against Manel Kopp. But where I referenced it, I mean, his last couple of fights, a fight of the night, wild one against Paiva and against Monturo.
That was a great fight.
You look at Dos Santos, small guys in the pocket can hit him to the body. He does have a high guard, and he brings his elbows down well, but where he gets hit by hooks to the body, and he gets hurt quite a bit. He gets hit by hooks around his guard, and that's exactly the Manel Kopp game plan. Plus, Kopp has some of the fastest hands in this division. So for me, Matt, the odds, yes, Manel Kopp is heavily favored against a short-notice debuting fighter who's 22 years old in the RSEG zone. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over-under 95% Kopp.
Under.
Under. 955 total votes, 94% Kopp, 26% by decision, 65% by knockout. For the 6% that have Leapy Dos Santos, Daytona. 37% by decision, 24% by submission. I've been wearing glasses all day. But when I look at this fight, Matt, I'm Manel Kopp. I mean, Felipe Dos Santos, it was a really fun rewatch. This guy is absolute hell on wheels. But defensively, he's a liability to your team. It's like having Dion Waiters out there. So for me, Matt, I like Starboy. But even in 2023, after a few years on the shelf, teams want Dion. Hopefully he doesn't eat those candies before he gets on the plane, but who do you have here?
I think Dos Santos is going to have a decent future in the UFC if they at least build him up right. Because at 22 years old, he does have a good base that you can improve on, but he can't just be matched up with other guys like Manel Kopp immediately after this fight. So I do think Manel has a great opportunity to win this fight. I definitely think he's going to win it, but I don't think Dos Santos is going to be one of those one-and-done UFC guys where we just kind of forget about after this matchup. I think it'll be a stock-gaining loss, but I do have Kopp winning.
Dos Santos might not win, but let's see if they give him Jimmy Flick next. Both of us going with Starboy, Manel Kopp to get the win. Got some big time fights. Co-main event, main event, and they are on the way. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
At a combined 38 knockout wins between them, top 10 ranked heavyweights pair off in the co-main event of UFC 293 coming up this weekend. Australia's own Bam Bam, Tai Tuivasa, looking to reverse fortunes off his last two losses. He's going to be taking on Drago Alexander Volkov, a man who got to the top of the mountain with other promotions, M1, Bellator, but not so in the UFC. And if you look at it for Volkov, he went on a crazy stretch a few years ago, wins in a fight of the night against Stefan Struve, and then he goes out there against Fabrizio Werdum, and he gets bread buttered, and he's working in takedowns. Who is this Volkov? We never see him, but for Volkov, he was able to have a lot of success, and since then, it's been a little bit of 50-50. He's moving up in the division to take on Tai Tuivasa, who's most recently lost to Cyril Gane in the UFC Paris main event a year ago, and then Sergey Pavlovich, where inside of a minute, he got dropped twice. But that's the number one contender. So
Sergey hits hard.
When you look at this fight, Matt, before that, Tuivasa was really moving. He had changed up camps. He was training in Dubai for his fights, and he was looking amazing. Breaking the distance, finishing Augusto Sakai, finishing Derek Lewis, making easy work of these guys. So now he's got a tough fight against the ever-durable Alexander Volkov, who his last time out, that was the UFC free fight that they threw out there on YouTube. He dispatched my guy, Alexander Romanov, made it look pretty darn easy too. So when you look at a fight like this, Volkov training in the States for this fight? Yeah, with Hani Marks? A guy who's always been the bridesmaid, never the bride. But when you look at a fight like this, Matt, I mean, for Volkov, tall, rangy. He can cardio kickbox for five rounds, let alone for three. And when you look at a guy like Tuivasa, devastating with his strikes, especially if he's able to crash that distance.
Oh, without a doubt. And that's where I do think Tai is going to have a lot of success in this matchup. When Volkov does get backed up, he is not nearly the fighter he is when he's moving forward. I would argue Alexander Volkov has one of the biggest differences in retreating and with his offense between retreating and leading the dance. Because when he's moving forward, oh my God, there's a lot you have to worry about. The guy's 6'7", throws head kicks, has good knees, has great volume, could throw from both stances, which is quite unique for a guy at his size and physique. But the one thing Volkov was not blessed with when he was given all these other physical attributes, the guy's not that fast. He does kill you with his volume more than anything, and it really is his pace and his pressure to go along with that volume. I remember being far too specific and getting way too cocky when he fought Alistair Overeem, and I was like, he's gonna knock him out with a left hook. Oh my God, he did it. Like, that's the thing about Volkov. When he did gain that mass after the Curtis Blaydes fight, and I'll be curious to see what he weighs in at, because the last few fights will sort of fluctuate up and down, not to the crazy, like, 20-pound difference.
Not 266 like Tuivasa.
Exactly. But for Volkov, it always has been, okay, if he's going to fight at 265, he is more of that march down type of fighter to where he wants to use his physicality a lot more. But I think this fight comes down to how likely Volkov is using those out-the-middle attacks. He does have good uppercuts when he's able to get that, like, kind of dirty boxing half clinch. He throws phenomenal uppercuts, but that's a position Tai also has great offense from. He throws good elbows over the top. His hands are quite a bit faster than Volkov's in that position, and that's why I have a hard time with this fight. I know Volkov, he should be a favorite, you know, just based on his body of work, but I just think the one area he's going to have a lot of success in is also going to open the door for Tai Tuivasa to land his own power shots. And I know Tai's coming off a devastating loss, don't get me wrong, but Volkov doesn't fight like Sergei Pavlovich. If he goes in there with his hands up, just marching forward, throwing crazy power shots, then I'll be the first person to admit that I'm wrong. I just think for Volkov, it's going to come down to, can he land the knees up the middle when they're at the long range to avoid some of the leg kicks of Tai Tuivasa? And can he make Tai pay with the uppercut when Tai does close the distance?
That's it. When you look at a guy like Volkov, whether he's just got the one hand behind or the plum clinch, he can mix things up. But those uppercuts are devastating. The knees are a big deal. The different things that Volkov's able to do at specific ranges. At length, he's able to throw some of those leg kicks out there, paw the jab, land it as a jab with the left hand or as the left hook. He can really paw with his right as well. And when you look at a guy like Tuivasa, whether it's his kicks, I'd say they're probably one of the underutilized portions of his game, but they are pretty good. But he has absolute hammers in his hands. And for Tuivasa, when was the last time we saw him back in Australia? I think it was off his loss when he took on Sergey Spivak, UFC 143 at Marvel Stadium, Whitaker versus Adesanya. Spivak was all the rage up until last week when he took on Cyril Gane. So for Tuivasa, we'll see if he's able to go out there against a longer, rangier guy in Volkov, crash the distance and make it his own fight, as he was able to do in that run-up, you know, with that win streak that he had. Now, Volkov is the favorite here in the blue corner, moving up in the division, so to speak, as far as the rankings are concerned. When we have a look at the fan vote over on Topology, surprise to us, it is to you. I'm going to say over, under, even though he's a hometown guy, Topology is worldwide, like it's Pitbull, Mr. Worldwide.
305.
I'm going to say over under 70% Volkov.
I think it'll be over.
I think it's going to be over. Oh, it's under. 1,140 total votes, 68% Volkov, 72% by knockout. For the 32% that have Tuivasa, 89% by knockout. Matt, who do you have in the matchup?
Tim, I'm sorry, buddy. I know you watch these. I have Tai Tuivasa to win this fight. Again, Alexander Volkov, when he is at his best, when he's at his most devastating, it's getting in close. And I know that sounds weird because he is such a long-rangey fighter, but he can get outworked from those ranges. We saw that in the Cyril Gane fight. And I know Tuivasa doesn't have the footwork of a Cyril Gane, but he's got great leg kicks on the outside. We saw that in the JDS fight. I know he lost that fight, but that was the first big step up in competition for Tai Tuivasa. I just think it comes down to the hand speed of Tai, and I think that's what is the difference between these two guys. So I expect it not to go exactly like the Augusto Sakai fight did, because Augusto wasn't throwing nearly as much back at Tai as Alexander Volkov will. But if he gets Volkov up against the cage and puts that posture upright, I do think those big power shots are going to be able to land.
Tai Tuivasa get into the UFC off a win over a guy who's fighting for glory in 2023 in James McSweeney. Won that fight. That was in Australia. Fought on that card that I talked about at the start of this video. The last time the UFC was in Sydney, UFC Fight Night Verdum versus Tybora, he beat Rashad Coulter, and that was a bonus winning fight. Then he beat Cyril Asker in Perth, but the last two times that Tuivasa fought in Australia, all the way in Adelaide. He loses to JDS and to Sergey Spivak back in Melbourne. So Matt, we'll see if he's able to return to his winning ways in his native Australia. For me, I'm going with Alexander Volkov in this fight. Switching things up, camp in the States for this one. Again, I think he's got the eye on the prize and he's going to be able to get the win. Matt, I can't wait for the walkouts for both these guys, because one guy is going to get booed into the ground and the other guy is going to get some of the loudest cheers you've heard since every French fighter in Paris last week. Why do they have Apex cards anymore? Budget, that's why. Matt, both of us split on the pick. You're going with Bam Bam Tai Tuivasa. I'm going with Drago Alexander Volkov. Back piece to win. Matt, the last time we had a fighter representing that country for Volkov with a back piece, it was Bogdan Guskov getting absolutely sent back to that region. Some big time fights on this card, including the main event for the title, Sean Strickland challenging one Israel Adesanya. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Main event, UFC 293. It's Israel Adesanya taking on Sean Strickland for that middleweight belt. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. And in this main event, it's not Dricus du Plessis. It was announced about a month ago by Dana White that Sean Strickland would be taking this fight. And listen, that announcement sandwiched between his win in the main event against unlikely challenger Abus Magomedov outside of the rankings, and then this matchup against Adesanya. For Adesanya, 10 straight main event. The last time a fighter had 10 straight main events, Matt, it was a Korean Zombie taking on Max Holloway not that long ago. TKZ off into the sunset. So when we have a look at this fight, Matt, I mean, for Adesanya, second run as the middleweight champ. His last time out in April, he dispatched his rival, Alex Pereira. Sent him up to light heavyweight, did he? And Matt, when we look at this fight, I mean, for Adesanya on the outside with his kicks and his kickboxing, we know how good it can be. And for Sean Strickland, we know how crazy the pressure can be.
Oh, yeah.
And he has great cardio, and he can last all five rounds. You saw that in the fight against Jared Cannonier, where it was a really tight affair. More of the power shots out of Cannonier to the volume out of Strickland. But even after that, on incredibly short notice, Strickland accepts the challenge up at 205 pounds, taking on Nasir Nemovov, wears on him with the pressure. He's able to win that fight. And again, against Magomedov, withstands the early storm in the first round to finish him in the second round and make him look like a chump. So when you look at this fight, I know people are going to have it either way. A lot of people want to see Strickland win because they just don't like Israel Adesanya. They want some of that new blood like Sean O'Malley winning the title. But when you look at a fight like this, kind of an unlikely challenger you're getting a look.
Yeah, plus 440 title challenger. They don't come around that often, guys. I can give two breakdowns of this fight. I can give one that is quite reductive to Sean Strickland and his ability to win this fight, but I want to give that one first. It's a little bit more fun. If Sean Strickland fights somebody who doesn't have exceptional punching power, really good footwork, or great cardio, he looks like a world beater. Like, let's give him his flowers with those respects. If he is able to just march forward, it doesn't really respect what's coming back his way, he's going to put on a clinic with his own output and with his own boxing combinations. But if you are a guy like a Jared Cannonier, and that fight was a close fight, don't get me wrong, it's not like Cannonier ran him over or anything, then Sean Strickland isn't as dedicated to that volume game. And yes, he outstruck Cannonier, but it's not that same in-your-face type of striking that we normally see from a Sean Strickland. And if you do have exceptional footwork, you can evade some of those strikes of Strickland, because he does tend to come in on a straight line and really do it. He does a good job of cornering his opponent after they're behind those two black lines, but in the center of the cage, he can get caught just waiting every now and then, like we saw against Alex Pereira. That was just the dumbest game plan I've ever seen in my life.
I'm not gonna take him down.
Yeah, what if I march straight forward with my chin up against potentially the most like terrifying striker we've ever seen in the UFC? But I'll just chalk that one up to it wasn't his night. But for Strickland, if he doesn't, I just said those three elements are really big and very important in a Sean Strickland fight. Let's just look at Israel Adesanya really quick. Does he hit hard? Yeah, he hits really hard. Especially
you see the Paulo Costa fight, which is kicks.
Yeah, you saw he knocked out Alex Pereira with one punch and then hit him a few more times and did a crazy celebration. But Adesanya, he hits quite hard. We can all agree on that.
He has good footwork, I think that's fair to say. Some of the best, I'd argue, we've ever seen in the weight division. And does he have good cardio? Yeah, he doesn't really fall off a cliff at any point throughout his fights. He is someone who will kick not only in the first round, but in the fourth and the fifth round too. And I think that's something that people are starting to catch on to a lot more. It's, hey, kicks in MMA are kind of like three-point shooting in the NBA. It's going to get you a lot of wins, don't get me wrong, but it's a lot harder to make those threes when you're tired in the fourth and third quarter. Same thing with kicks. You do see fighters who are very kick-heavy start to fall off and plateau near the end of fights because it takes so much energy throwing those types of techniques. But for Adesanya, he does a great job with his own elusiveness on the back foot. He can land counter shots for power especially and from different angles as well. And I don't think this is a case of, oh, if Strickland can just get to the third round, he can start to overcome Israel Adesanya. So since he doesn't have any of those three building blocks in place for him, I do think it's a difficult fight for Strickland to go out there and make a game plan for. Because is he a better grappler than Adesanya? Probably, you know, if we're really counting every part of their games. But Adesanya is a really good defensive grappler, especially at this stage of his career. It's the one thing that everyone's tried to exploit for the longest time in his career. Yes, Jan Blachowicz was able to take him down, up 20 pounds, but Sean Strickland used to fight at 170. Jan Blachowicz would have to cut off now, both his legs to make 170 now, pounds.
Sean Strickland's last title fight was this time, 10 years ago, with King of the Cage. Strickland was the middleweight champ with King of the Cage, and then he came into the UFC. He's been 14-5 since that point. 170, little bit of a problem, diminishing returns. The Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos fight is one that people go back to, the spinning wheel kick knockout. But when you look at Strickland at 185 pounds, look at the last two losses. Alex Pereira, Jared Cannonier, the split decision in the main event, Imavov, and then, of course, last time out against Abusmagomedov. Matt, that was Canada Day. The family, they were over. We were watching the fireworks, and I was watching Sean Strickland absolutely decimate Magomedov. And we knew how big of a striker Magomedov could be.
What would Adesanya do to him?
Again, when he fell off in the second round, that was it. He was huffing and puffing for air as we were going between the rounds. So if you look at Strickland, A-plus cardio. We know that.
Definitely.
He's got really good durability. He can continue to march forward in the majority of these fights. We've seen a little bit of an uptick in the volume and the aggressiveness since that horrible motorcycle accident that he had where he lost a piece of his kneecap. And hardly anybody's targeted his legs with leg kicks. Strickland does a pretty good job of at least trying to check a lot of the leg kicks. And that could dissuade a lot of people from making that a target. But if you look at it for Strickland, I mean, when he's fighting guys that maybe weren't the best in the division, but we all remember the Jack Marishman fight where he's trying to egg him into it, the Brendan Allen fight where he's finishing him in the second round, and even the Uriah Hall fight that was pretty sad. It's been an impressive performance for Sean Strickland as he's gone along. And again, he fought such names as Crusher, Court McGee, Nordin Taleb, and Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada.
Jack
and of course,
Marishman.
Jack Marishman,
or Hermanson,
a fight that nobody will ever forget. Hermanson, yes. So when it does come down to this matchup, Matt, Adesanya, good with the strike on the outside. The only thing that I'm going to look for throughout this fight week is if people start to talk about Adesanya moving up to 205. That's conversation. I'm picking Sean Strickland to win this fight because it happened with Usman. It happened with Sterling during the fight week before a title fight, and they both lost. So I don't want to hear that out of City Kickboxing or Adesanya, who just turned 34 ahead of this contest. But Matt, we have a look at this one. Adesanya is a pretty darn big favorite. We threw it out to you guys in the YouTube community tab, and you guys do an awesome job at throwing out the comments and the votes for these. 769 votes as of the last couple hours. 76% going with Adesanya. Some of the comments. Fight Hive. I think Izzy might go back to his snooze fest ways. Sean won't be able to find Izzy with how slowly he plods around, and Izzy might try to just drift on the outside and play Matador five rounds. Sad, but I think likely. Izzy by boring 50-45. Bill Shakespeare, you gotta be a next level Izzy hater to pick Strickland here. And Jack Lawson saying the only downside to Strickland winning is that we won't get to see Dricus humiliate Adesanya. So Matt, when you are making a pick on this one, again, it's tough when you have a fighter who's so big of a favorite in Adesanya. There's definitely talking points for Strickland with the jawing. I'm sure the press conference and everything's gonna be interesting in the build up to this one. But for me, I have Israel Adesanya, and I don't think that's going to be a surprise to many people.
Do you know Jaylen Brown's going to play in a big three game? It's pretty exciting, right? I think Israel Adesanya is going to beat Sean Strickland, and I'll just let that Jaylen Brown big three reference.
Now,
he's probably going to score 70 in that
game. I picked Aljamain Sterling to beat Sean O'Malley, so main events aren't always right, and title fights aren't always right.
But I also did say the exact way Sean O'Malley would win that fight if he did, and it would be Aljamain overextending on a shot and getting hit by a counter. So I do think we bring up some red flags for the challengers, even if we don't pick them. And just for Strickland, I bring it up. The three ways he wins the majority of his fights: Adesanya does counter all three of those big assets that Sean Strickland does have. And I think Strickland's going to be around in the top 10 for a long time because his skill set is one of those, hey, it's kind of like a fraud check, right? Like, if you don't have great cardio, if you're a bit of a pretender and not really a contender, Sean Strickland's going to be the guy to get to the root of a lot of your weaknesses in your MMA game. But I just don't think his plodding forward style is going to work against Adesanya in this matchup. Hopefully it is a fun fight. Hopefully it's not like what a few of our commenters have said, just one of those Adesanya playing on the back foot, landing a few pitter-patter counter shots. Because if he does do that, he can definitely get the win, but it's not really going to set up any of the future opponents like the Dricus du Plessis fight that I know a lot of people are excited for.
It will be a big time matchup in this main event. Both of us going with the last stylebender to get the win. Matt, that Sean Strickland walkout, like the Saints come marching in or whatever it is. It's just one of the worst in all of MMA, but we're looking forward to it. Again, a lot of debuting fighters on this card. There's five of them total. There's three second times out. There's a rematch that ended in a no contest due to an eye poke between Justin Taffa and Austin Lane. It's one of the weaker pay-per-view cards that you're going to see this year. But again, moving it forward, the next fight night card, UFC Noche, they're building that one up big time. There's a title fight in the main event, the rematch between Grasso and Shevchenko. If anything changes throughout this fight week, because it did last week with UFC Paris, you guys make sure you subscribe and you toss a like on the video so you know that we go live and when these videos are about to drop. Question mark kicks should be at a relatively normal time here on Saturday. It's always 2 hours before the prelims, unless something changes. And we're pretty early about getting those ones out. So you can always find us X and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP here for Fight Week. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.